Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Release the beast and purge in our American streets. Your new founding fathers encourage your participation.
This is not a test. This is your emergency broadcast system announcing the commencement of the annual purge sanctioned by the U.S. government. Weapons of Class 4 and lower have been authorized for use during the purge. All other weapons are restricted. Government officials of ranking 10 have been granted immunity from the purge and shall not be harmed. Commencing at the siren, any and all crime, including murder, will be legal for 12 continuous hours. Police, fire, and emergency medical services will be unavailable until tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. when the purge concludes. Blessed be our new founding fathers and America, a nation reborn. May God be with you all.
Olson, who goes by the name Megatron on Twitter, wrote, "If we had a real-life purge, I would kill as many Mexicans as I could in one night. Hashtag, learn how to tip, you blanking blank."
Yeah, I was offended by it.
Olson's next-door neighbor says he, too, has worked in the restaurant industry, so he knows what it's like not to get a tip. But
if you're going to go on social media that brightly and say what she said, you need to be removed from that public position.
Generation Latino says it's no surprise that we're seeing comments like this in this political climate. The executive director says the vitriol and hate is real and adds that Latinos shouldn't have to face verbal and physical abuse in their own country that they love to do.
If the state has other reasons for believing somebody has moved, for example, if they get information from the post office indicating that that person's address has changed, it can initiate the process for removing voters. What neither Ohio nor any other state can do is to initiate the purge process solely because of a registered voter's failure to vote.
But Ohio did. Six other states, Alaska, Montana, South Dakota, Tennessee, Georgia, and West Virginia, also consider voter inactivity when striking names from lists of registered voters.
Do many of these folks not know that they have been purged?
Many of them will not realize that they've actually been removed from the rolls until they go to vote. We think that the biggest impact is going to be felt in urban areas, especially places where you've got less affluent voters.
Ohio has removed infrequent voters off the voter roll.
Community organizer Andre Washington is spreading the word about Ohio's voting rules at Tridestone Baptist Church, one of Columbus's largest predominantly black churches. He has also joined the lawsuit against the Secretary of State.
Most of the people that they purged look like me and you.
Washington fears Ohio's purge practice will disenfranchise African Americans who have not voted since 2008, when they helped elect the first black president.
Indianapolis teen Jonathan Cruz is accused of killing three people in 4 days in a twisted crime spree that was inspired by the horror movie The Purge. The attacks appeared to be totally random. Cruz gunned down Billy Boyd and Jay Higginbottom on May 12th and murdered Jose Ruiz 3 days later. He is also accused of robbing a man at gunpoint on May 14th. In The Purge, murder and all crimes are legal for 12 hours in an annual rite of violence. Cruz has been jailed since his May 16th arrest on felony charges from a confrontation with a teenage girl at Wendy's 2 days earlier. He had threatened the girl with a gun and kept her from leaving. Prosecutors say they will consider the death penalty.
Hordes of young adults are arriving from Spain, Denmark, South Africa. They're being called murder tourists, as they are here for one reason: to purge.
We're here to experience the purge, to kill, release all the anger and hate, be like Americans. We're very excited. Some here, they should be Afrikaners to do. Now it's come for you.
Foreigners coming to our capital to kill. Murder tourism is the new booming business in our country this year.
Murder tourism. What's happened to our country, Joe?
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, August 3rd, 2016, so I have been told. Took a bit of arm twisting for us to do a program, for me personally to be motivated to do a program focused on the Purge franchise. Do encourage reading is more important than watching television. You can learn quite a bit watching films. Lots of messaging, lots of politics about the system of white supremacy are promoted, broadcast through films. I certainly want to encourage folks to make as much time to read as possible. But this particular set of films I have talked about for years, back when the first installment came out in 2013. They just released the third film just literally weeks ago, July 4th weekend. The set of films has made approximately $300 million. That is important, but not primary when analyzing this film or these films and their significance. Hopefully, folks will get some constructive information from the broadcast today in terms of why I think these films have been so wildly popular, why they have made so many of them in such short succession, and particularly looking at the context of when these films have been released and what they are about. Thought one of our guests, who has made many trips to the cows to discuss the significance of films and kind of deconstruct a lot of the messaging, white supremacy messaging that happens in films. He's been on the program repeatedly and written an entire book about the subject in terms of racism, white supremacy in films. We've discussed his book, Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America. Fascinating book, lots of constructive detail. You can go back in the archives and hear our discussion on the text and some of the films that he breaks down in that text and some of the other films that we broke down over the years on the program. Our guest, he is in the Department of English at the University of Texas, Austin. Importantly, he has a PhD in English. I have pointed that out repeatedly when analyzing the system of white supremacy. Words are extremely important. I always think it is highly significant when we have guests on the program who have particular skill, expertise with words. I think they can pinpoint a lot of specific aspects of racism, white supremacy with definitions, the way that words are used. In fact, that's where we're going to start at today, the definition of purge. Joining us live once again, our guest, Dr. Martin Kevorkian. Let's see, Dr. Kevorkian, are you with us, sir?
I hope so. Hello? Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. I heard a thing that said audio muted or something like that. But Mr. Gusty Rendy, thank you for that very kind introduction, and thank you for welcoming me back to the show. Thank you for that excellent lead-in, which really made a connection based on words that I had not drawn, but it's such a striking one to hear the way the word and the phrase purge process was being used to describe the elimination of voters from the voting rolls. I thought of that general connection to the moves that are being made to disenfranchise voters around the country, but I had not even noticed that it was even being called a purge. It's just stunning. So that's the insight right at the top of the hour from your setup, sir.
For sure. Grand to have you back with us. I'm sure there are folks who have not heard some of your previous visits on the program. Anything you think would be significant for them to know about who you are, the work that you do, or a tidbit you want to drop about color monitors?
Maybe some of this will come up in the discussion of the Purge franchise. One of the things, you said it took a little arm twisting to get you to watch these, and you pointed out to me, you said, you weren't that eager to see them, but you said, you might be interested in, because there's even a robot in the first one. One of the things that we see in Hollywood is an association of technology and technological labor with blackness, and particularly as a way of containing or reducing the violence, the threat of violence that is assumed by these films to come from the black body. So that's one of the things I've attempted to analyze in that book. But we see that same kind of dynamic going on certainly in the first of the Purge movies, in which that robot really is associated with kind of symbolically neutralizing the threat of the non-white person in the house. We could talk more about those scenes, but that was the thing that kind of rang my bell in terms of color monitors. But there are much bigger and much more important things going on than that specific hobby horse of mine about technology. So I'll trust you to sort of set us up for the context of what you think the big points are here. I don't want to sidetrack it just into my little thing about technology. So thank you.
For sure. We'll get that in as we hop into the films. And again, for folks who haven't seen you or heard the previous broadcast, you are a white man. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I know one. Definitely, I would encourage go back in the archives, hear some of our earlier episodes. I linked a few of them in the description for the program. You'll hear more about color monitors and some of Dr. Kevorkian's views on the system of white supremacy. Starting out, definitions again, having someone who has a PhD in English, the definition for purge, there are many. I'll read some of them. They start out with the verb purge, rid someone of an unwanted feeling, memory, or condition, typically given a sense of cathartic release. Next definition, to free someone from an unwanted feeling, memory, or condition. Next, these are all verbs. To remove as in a group of people considered undesirable from an organization or place in an abrupt or violent manner. I would certainly underline that one with this set of films. Scrolling down a little bit to physically remove something completely, and then going down to use purge as a noun, an abrupt or violent removal of a group of people from an organization or place. And I will stop there just with the definition of purge. I think that is a critical place because all of these elements, all of these definitions, connotations, denotations of the word purge, I think, are present in all three of the films. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these films are absolutely overlap. The thing that was in common with all those definitions was getting rid of something unwanted. And the idea that these films seem to be based on is that it would be attractive to get rid of unwanted feelings, that first definition, by getting rid of suddenly and abruptly unwanted groups. The act of violence produces the catharsis. You get rid of you can put away your bad feelings by having this outlet of violence. It's about a fantasy of violence and one that could be pursued with impunity against the unprotected and the unprivileged.
I think for these films, they do say exactly what you just said. The unprotected, the unprivileged, the poor, In my view, they don't say it explicitly that the undesirable, the folks that we're supposed to be getting rid of, are black people. But it is very apparent, in my view, if you watch any of these films, the people that most of the energy is targeting in terms of these are the folks we should be getting rid of. The problem is it is black people. And I would have to state explicitly, it's not people of color. It's not black and brown people. It's not dark skinned people in general. It's not Asian people. It's black people specifically. And I think that's pointed out in the films. Do you think that's an accurate statement, Dr. Kevorkian?
I think that is absolutely accurate. I mean, I've got, you know, sort of some rough points written down, and that's point number two. Maybe it really could have been point number one, but the film is always talking about itself, and it seems to want to think of itself as being about the rich versus poor, but it is very much about race. And on this topic, I would recommend a book by one of your other guests, The Minority Reporters. The book I have in mind is called You Mean There's Race in My Movie? And it's a book that really calls out this idea that there are many films that seem to think that they're not about race, but they really are. And it's nowhere clearer or more visible than in this franchise. And you're actually right. It's not just non-whites generically. So much of the energy is about black men and black women even.
Absolutely. That's a point that I think a lot of times people just try to make this some general thing that it's against people of color or black and brown people. I think that's almost a ubiquitous phrase. People talk about racism, black and brown people. That is not what this film is communicating. This film, in my view, it is specifically targeting black bodies, male and female. And I wanted to get your thoughts. It seems to play out in all of these films. There is an overtly flaunted leaning on incorporating a lot of the most, I think, iconic, the iconography and symbolism of the United States. You have like the Statue of Liberty. You have the third film was released on the 4th of July weekend. If you see some of the movie posters for the films, they have the American flag incorporated in some way. Some of them have Uncle Sam incorporated. He's going out to purge the character Uncle Sam. They have others, as I said, with the Statue of Liberty. A lot of times the people that are going out to do this purging, the killing, they're wearing masks of former presidents, Abraham Lincoln, Richard Nixon, George Washington. Even interestingly, the trailer for the first film, which came out in 2013, it has America the Beautiful is playing in the background as they're advertising this film about going out to kill. They have in some of the photographs, it has a picture of the Constitution. In fact, that's how the purge was brought about. They made a new amendment to the Constitution. I think it's Amendment 28. Now we will have the purge where violence killing is legal one day a year. What do you think is going on with incorporating so much of the iconography of the United States? I would say iconography of white supremacy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I often associate when you talk about something coming out on July 4th, I think of that famous essay and speech by Frederick Douglass, you know, what to a slave is the 4th of July? That it's the one day of the year that's most makes most evident the contradictions of the United States, that it's a country that claims to be founded on the principles of freedom and yet has had unfreedom built into its practice from the beginning through the enslavement of black bodies, most notably and most for the longest period of time throughout history. So this is a film in which those contradictions are right there on the surface. One of the things I was curious to get your take on, I noticed that you let in with the idea of these murder tourists who, you know, are coming from abroad to take part in this purge. And in fact, in the third one, they're the ones who are wearing these masks and these costumes to show really like the costumes of Abraham Lincoln and Uncle Sam. And they are expressing their hatred of America and Americans, even as and actually in scenes where they are threatening some of the white characters. So it seems like, you know, it strikes me in those scenes that it surprised me. You know, based on the advertising, I didn't think it was going to go that way. It seems like it wants to, on the one hand, align the Purge with this American value of freedom. So many of the people who are purging it are saying, this is my constitutional right. On the other hand, there's always this kind of pullback where the appropriation of these icons is something that's being done by outsiders, by foreigners, and that somehow that saps it of its association with those icons. I don't know if I'm making sense there, but this is something that I found bewildering about what was going on with that, the murder of tourism and its association with those costumes.
Mm. And this is in the third one for folks out there. So you've already had to go through two other installments before it gets to this point where they do kind of keep things. I think the franchise broadens as it goes. The first one is kind of exclusively focused on one house. And then the next one is it broadens out a little bit. And then the third one, it broadens out even more where you've got the presidential election going on, and these people are coming in from other parts of the world. The portion that you're talking about that I played in the intro, I thought it was important, hugely significant. They have this group of tourists, international tourists, coming to the States specifically for the opportunity to kill. But the person that they put on the microphone is from South Africa. Now, I think that pops in people's minds for a lot of reasons with association of racism, white supremacy. And I think at the end, when he gives his talk about coming here to participate, he begins speaking Afrikaans. And I want to talk with some of our folks in South Africa to see if they can translate exactly what he's saying when he gets to the end of that. But I thought, I think many of the people on our program before have talked about the number one export from this area of the world is white supremacy and anti-black concepts around the world that have influenced countless other white people around the world in terms of how to practice, how to manage the system of racism, white supremacy. This happened even with Nazi Germany, where they looked at a lot of the things that were happening here with eugenics and said, that's a good idea. We should do that here too. And even South Africa, some of the same things happened where they looked at things that were being done here and how black people were being abused and terrorized and said, oh, we should incorporate some of those strategies here. To me at least, it suggested this notion that something could be happening in this part of the world where whites from other places could be encouraged to come in for an opportunity to kill black people. It reminds me even of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, where that did happen, where people were bringing Israeli troops. This is documented in Gary Rivlin's book, Katrina After the Flood. He's a writer with the New York Times. He was a guest on our program at the end of last year, but he documents this, where Israeli troops were brought in to defend, safeguard. Well, I mean, talk about purge. Hurricane Katrina right there. Real life illustration, so that people don't think that this is just wacky fantasy that could not happen. But bringing in armed white guards to protect and preserve white life. And certainly a lot of black people were killed who were not looters, who were not doing anything, just life unworthy of life. Same kind of sentiment that was expressed in the Purge. But that's kind of my response to that, if it makes sense. I certainly also wanted to get your take because Pam, also one of our former guests, she was just with us last week. In fact, she shared a few comments on the Purge. The website is not up now, but you can get the cached pages so you can see the archives of what it looks like. And again, that same sentiment of pulling on a lot of the iconography and symbolism of the United States. They had a website that was the New Founding Fathers of America. And this is the political group in this franchise that starts the purge. They come to power, it says, in 2015, and they have the first purge in 2018. And this is all about, they've got all this crime and poverty. And so the purge, this is supposed to be an opportunity to get rid of moochers, the takers, as Mitt Romney said back in 2012, people that don't contribute anything and they're just messing it up and robbing, and we get unemployment down to 1%. This website that they set up, it does not look like the typical type of website that you would set up for a film to advertise. It looks like this is a legitimate political organization. Like it has a poll. Do you think purging is part of human nature? And you can vote in the poll. It has a picture of the Capitol building. It has the platform for the new founding fathers of America, and it has all of these wonderful statistics about how great things are in the United States since they've been purging for a number of years, that employment is way down. It even a line that says violence is human, purging is patriotic. And it's got a picture of the Bill of Rights in the background with bullet shells on top of the Constitution. What do you think the attempt, what is being communicated with having a website like this set up to promote this film?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really dangerous. I mean, I think they're just playing with fire with this franchise in so many ways. You talk about really looking at messaging. I think that this is a franchise that wants to get off the hook by giving a lot of mixed messaging. But when you have a website like that that stands on its own, right, it's not being framed in the movie. There's no story around it that says, hey, by the way, this is what the bad guys think. I think that's a tremendously dangerous and destructive ideology to be then potentially seen as glorifying. I think there are just a lot of two steps in this movie, in that really a lot of the time the audience, you know, even while the purge is going on, you're being set up to see the people who are doing the purging as the villains. And so then there gets to be then this second wave of violence where the so-called, you know, good violence, as opposed to what is portrayed as supposedly the bad violence took place before. You know, the bad violence was when they were killing, the victims of the purge, the ones that were on the outside. And then the good killing is when the so-called, you know, the good guys get to come in and commit violence against the people who are doing the purging. But the problem with that is it's all portrayed as blood sport, and it's all served up as entertainment based on killing and killing as justified. And you get a website like that, it sounds like it's justifying that first kind of killing, the killing that the movie sort of wants to claim that it is showing is bad, but having it promoted in that way. And you're right. The thing about, you know, the opening crawl in both of those first two films is like a sales pitch for what a great idea this would be, right? The idea that the crime statistics, the unemployment statistics. And I noticed the idea that, maybe it's just a tiny detail. In the second film, in the first film, they have unemployment at 1%. And in the second film, they actually have unemployment at 5%. And I guess that's supposed to suggest why then the government has to more actively get in on the action in the purging in the second film and going forward. But that's it becomes the forefront more and more as the franchise goes on is the idea of active government complicity in this, and even as you noted in the third film, it's not just white supremacists. There's the Afrikaner right at the beginning being spoken, but then there are also clearly white supremacists are kind of the weirdly professional mercenary thugs that are hired to take out the senator who is the anti-purge candidate. They're very clearly marked as being both authorized by the government and being white supremacists at the same time.
Absolutely. In my view, at least, it supported the notion that the government is white supremacist, since these folks have been authorized. They're working for the government, and it does not get any clearer. They have white power emblazoned on their uniforms and swastikas. I mean, the whole nine. This is not, you know, Gus T. Renegade is saying it's white. I mean, it's clearly in the film. One thing I did want to get in just before we kind of break down some of the details of the first film, hear a few of the sound clips, kind of go through each film, and then hear some of the thoughts from listeners as well, because I know quite a few of them have seen one or all of these films. Just for anybody, because I know some people said that they knew people, even knew some black people who just said, hey, this is just entertainment. You know, you all are talking nonsense. This is just good old Hollywood fun. You get your popcorn and go enjoy. Nobody is thinking about doing this for real. And this does not, you know, impact. Certainly they're not going to have any really authorized government purging, where people are allowed to go out and commit crimes, much less murder people. Certainly that's not going to happen. I would say, one, on this website that they put up, which you can still access the archives, it says One Night to Save America, and it's got the Statue of Liberty in the background. It almost reminded me, somebody has a slogan that says, Make America Great Again. I cannot think of where that comes from. That's one. And then two, you did hear in the beginning, I did play a clip from the film, which Dr. Kevorkian mentioned. I also played an authentic, or actually two authentic news clips. One was a waitress who was fired in Colorado, where she went online and posted that she wished that there was one night to purge. She would kill as many Mexicans as possible because they didn't tip her well. And then there was Jonathan Cruz, a 19-year-old white male in Indiana, who said he was inspired by this film, killed three people. He's now facing the death penalty. This was months ago. This is not ancient history. Both of those incidents happened within the last 2 months. Jonathan Cruz is facing the death penalty. It's stated in the Washington Post that he had a particular level of contempt for black people. Again, it didn't say people of color, didn't say non-white people, it didn't say black and brown people, black people. And one of the people that he killed was a black male, unarmed black male that he just saw. Oh, I think I'll kill him. Bang, shot him dead for no reason. Called him some racial slurs, according to the report that was in the Washington Post, and then moved along. I think that is hugely important. And those are just two incidents that I could pull in terms of people who think that, oh, this is just entertainment and this, you know, is not communicating any messages, certainly not encouraging this way of thinking. Any comments, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, first I want to say I recommend looking at that article in the Washington Post. Thank you for sending me the link to that. And it was just so striking that, in fact, that this man in Indiana had used those racial epithets in such a clearly targeted manner, that he was taking this as a expression of his hatred, that was very much purely racially charged. You mentioned that, you know, that there's the slogan, someone has a slogan, you know, Make America Great Again. I did think that this resonated with a lot of the messaging that is coming from that campaign, and the messaging that is resonating with angry white men, young men who see themselves as disenfranchised. I can't remember now which of the films it is, but there's one of the new founding fathers whose name is, I think, Donald Talbot. He's on screen. Did you catch that detail?
I did not. I will have to check as we're going.
There's someone that's definitely, his initials were DT. I can remember the name. I might not have the first name, but it was D was the first name, and Talbot was the last one. But DT was his initials, and he was clearly one of the new founding fathers. He's one of like the talking heads that you see on the television at one point. And I'll just say that, that slogan, you know, Make America Great Again, I mean, it's terrifying, you know, the idea of turning back the clock, that there was some golden age when things were so great. One of the things I think that is, what's strange about that campaign and it's strange about the movie is that it seems to be so much about portraying in the movie the bloodlust of these wealthy white Americans. On the other hand, when you think of that campaign, what the polls are showing is that DT's biggest lead is among what, you know, pollsters might categorize as less educated or uneducated white men. And this is a Pew survey that I read about. And they say it's not even about, most people think it's talking about the economy, but they said that these are white people really who see themselves outside of the system of privilege, that white privilege is not benefiting them, and that they don't like two things. They don't like immigrants. They don't like the idea that people are coming from outside of America and changing it. And they also say that they specifically feel like they don't like the idea that soon so-called minorities will be in the majority, that they see that as a negative trend. And they see this political leader, DT, as someone who feels the way they do. And I'll just say that, you know, this is a movie franchise that is you know, puts on screen what that desire looks like, what that desire looks like to reduce that sector of the population, the minority portion of the population.
I was able to locate it as we were talking. Donald Talbot, that is from the 2014 release, so that would be film number 2, The Purge Anarchy, and they have a scene where Donald Talbot, he's on a big, monstrous-sized screen, and he's talking in favor of the Purge. He's one of the new founding fathers of America, so this is before the Trump campaign even got rolling officially, but good eye for Dr. Kevorkian. Getting to some of the details, starting out with the first film to kind of break down some of the things that stood out specifically. As I said, also have a few sound clips as well to play. Two of the things that I think are most important, context of white supremacy, again, where we are in terms of context, and just a quick frame. It was on the second. I missed the Donald Talbot, but one thing I did catch in the 2013, which is the first film in this franchise, and also should be emphasized, the budget for this first film was pretty low. It was less than $5 million. This film did approximately $80 million at the box office. That is like an anomaly of sorts. You generally do not have films that have that low of a budget that end up doing that well at the box office. In fact, it did so well that they turned around and made the sequel within a year. That is a bit strange. Not that it never happens, but you generally don't have that sort of thing, particularly with, this is not The Matrix. This was not a franchise that they came out and spent $100 million to make the first film on for this to become a success. Easily a success in Hollywood terms in terms of the amount of money and the number of people that have seen it and the cultural impact, in my opinion. But two of the things that I think are extremely important in evaluating the first film, this film came out in June of 2013. At the time when I think one of the most important events, not just of 2013, but probably one of the more important moments in this part of the world in the last 5 years, I would say, this film came out within days of the trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida. This first Purge film is about an unarmed black male being literally hunted by a mob of whites. They want to kill him. He hasn't done anything to him. This is their right to be able to kill this black male because it's Purge night with impunity. That's one. The second thing is that if you watch the very beginning, and I think it's even in some of the trailers for the first film, if you watch the very beginning of the first Purge, they have what they call Purge Feed. So they're showing video clips of people killing, violence that's happening as a part of the Purge. In one of the clips, they show actual footage from the 1992 rioting, as they called it, that took place after the officers were acquitted for beating Rodney King. In fact, the clip, it shows two Asian shop owners. They have their pistols out. They're firing, defending their shop. But they put this up. They don't put this up and label it as that. They put this up and just label this as Purge Feed from like South Dakota, somewhere not even in California. But they include that in the rest of the clips. I'm not sure if the rest of the clips that they include in this montage, if they are staged, if this is, you know, something that they made up and this just happened to include this one authentic image, or if they also included some other image that are other images that are actual violence taking place. But I thought those two things, the timing of this film coming out in the middle of this trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin and the inclusion of this snippet of film from the LA riots, and particularly the way that I hear white people talk about that event in 1992. If folks even remember, this film came out in 2013. There was a lot of talk in 2012 about the 20-year anniversary of the riots that took place in Los Angeles. And in fact, Rodney King had died about a year before this film came out. He was found dead in his swimming pool. Just do you think those two aspects are important in terms of how one should evaluate this film?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this is a backdrop of an ongoing history. And that word that you highlighted, that idea of being able to kill with impunity, that was, the most shocking thing of the George Zimmerman trial, that it was something that appeared to be like hunting. And nevertheless, there was a jury that identified with Zimmerman. you know, basically asserted his right to act in that arbitrary and violent way. I think there's so many disgusting things about it, but one of the disgusting things that was a woman on the jury who said, and forgive me if I get this wrong, but the way I remember her saying it, she said, George had a right to defend himself. And I just found that so disturbing on so many levels, but you know, starting with the fact that so obviously just the familiarity of calling him George, like that this was someone who identified and sort of invested emotionally in Zimmerman and saw things from his perspective and then asserted what he did as something that he had a right to do. So this idea of assertion of a right and killing with impunity, I think is a super important context for thinking about the appeal of these films at that time.
Mm. No. Absolutely. Even in my view, I think this notion of justified violence against black people, I think that certainly was a major aspect of Trayvon Martin being killed with impunity, no one being convicted, Rodney King, violence being justified against black people. And it certainly comes out in the press. That's part of the backbone that these people, it's said in the film, I have the sound clip coming up, but I just think that that's huge. And I think at least for me, including that segment, even I suspect a lot of people would go see that film, they would not recognize that image from the LA riots. But I think a lot of things happen on a subconscious level in viewing this, that it's just expected that black people deserve to be purged, whether it's from the voting rolls or Trayvon Martin, Rodney King. They don't behave correctly. They're high. They're potential looters. And they need to be gotten rid of. And things would just be a lot better. I think that sentiment is feeding on that from the very beginning of the film, the very beginning of this franchise. In the first, before you meet any of the characters and figure out what's going on, just having that implanted. And while this is coming out in the middle of the trial, I think it's huge in terms of what's being communicated, the politics. And why I say this is not entertainment. This, in my view, it is deliberately promoting, broadcasting white supremacist views and, in my view, even encouraging an escalation of violence against black people. One of the next things that I noted from this, in fact, before I can even get to what I think is a big aspect of the film, I'll play one of the first sound clips. This is from the first Purge. So this is Ethan Hawke is playing the patriarch in this film, this white father, husband, the Sandlin family. He sells security, which I think is significant. He sells security and he's going home to be with his white family, white wife. He has a daughter and a son. He's going home to be with them for the purge. He's not going out to kill anybody. They're just going to lock their house down and sit for the evening. And so the alarm goes off at 7 p.m. in the evening that the purge will commence. I played exactly the way it plays out on the television. I played that at the beginning audio. So after the alarm goes off to announce that the purge has commenced, his son, Charlie, he looks at Ethan Hawke's character, who is the white male in Training Day, who was opposite Denzel Washington. His son comes in, and you'll hear it in the audio clip. His son asks for an explanation about this night and his white parents' relationship to the purge. So this is first clip from the purge 2013.
Okay, kids. Now, I know bad things do happen tonight, but we can afford protection. So we'll be fine just like always. No worries, okay? Okay?
Can I go now? I would prefer to be miserable in my room.
Of course you may. Thank you for being here.
Charlie.
Wait, where are you going, bud?
Hey. Charlie.
Why don't you guys do it?
Because we don't feel the need to, Charlie. That's all.
So if you felt the need to, you would kill someone tonight?
Look, I know this is difficult to understand at your age, but tonight allows people a release for all the hatred and violence and aggression that they keep up inside them. Okay? And yes, if your mother and I were so inclined, we would participate. Because it works. You don't remember how bad it was, Charlie. The poverty, all the crime. This night saved our country.
Context of white supremacy. Anything stand out to you in particular about that segment?
Well, I mean, one of the things, I mean, that I feel about the first two films is that it wants to make the young people, the child, in this case, Charlie, in the second film, I believe it's Lainey, wants to make them kind of a moral center of these films, where otherwise everyone around them is sort of giving in to this ideology. And so there's just a little bit of the possibility of hope that this kind of, what it's really demonstrating is the way that this white supremacy is taught, right? It's showing on the one hand something that I believe is true, that racism is not natural, right? That people are not born hating. And so it wants to sort of hit that note to allow you to feel good about, you know, the kid who is asking these questions. But then there's a chilling idea that you might be witnessing the process whereby he's learning this ideology. I think the film wants to make you continue to be able to feel good about the kid as he, you know, makes some decisions that can be celebrated. But the portrayal of the father, I think, is absolutely chilling. I don't know if you're going to play it later, but he's got one of the most chilling lines in all the franchise, where he says, "We're going to give them what they want." Is that one that you're going to play later, or should I talk about that?
You certainly can. I think the young white lad, when he comes to make his initial offer to the Sandlands about how they can proceed, I think that one, at least for me, I think that one is a tad more chilling, but certainly feel free to talk about that line.
I guess the difference that I think about, you know, the Ethan Hawke character is that when the guy comes up to the screen, I mean, that's the most disturbing language in the film. The guy he's described as this Harvard, you know, brat who is out purging, and his portrayal, the way he acts it, he is meant to be a disgusting character. The audience is meant to feel loathing toward this young white man who comes and is trying to intrude on the family and is trying to get them to go along with his right to purge. What I find chilling about the Ethan Hawke character is that, you know, here's a big star. As you say, he's already been associated with some questionable movies. I think there's some shocking things that go on in Training Day as well, against the Denzel Washington character. But this is someone who's supposed to be sort of on the side of the audience, not the person you're supposed to root against. And to have him come to this moment of ethical judgment, which is, are we going to give up this black man and give him to that hideous person who's out there talking on the screen and saying, "I have the right to purge"? And he says yes. That to me is just that shocking moment. Later, he recants it. He says, "I made a mistake." In a sense, he pays the price for it, in the sense that his character does not survive the film. But I think that sort of giving in to the ideology of the purge, that moment where it just becomes something where even, you know, the family that, you know, might be the thing that the audience is supposed to be sort of rooting for, gives in to this ideology. Even as in the clip you just played, says, "We do it because it works," right? He has bought into it. That's the thing that seems to me alarming. It's not just the obviously twisted, purger out there on the street, the white punk with the college degree. It's the family inside that is going to go along with this, and this logic that they are willing to sacrifice this black man. And I just think that line, "We're going to give them what they want," that's the motto of the whole franchise. That's the producer speaking. That's the people backing the film speaking, right? That, as you said, this every film gets bigger and bigger. And if you listen to some of the commentary tracks, that's what they say. They say people wanted more and more and more of this. They wanted a bigger lens. They wanted to see more of the purging that's taking downtown of the urban areas. And I think, you know, we all know what that kind of desire would be. And every time, you know, the producers, you know, get a positive response for that kind of thing, they say the same thing Ethan Hawke says, which is we're going to give them what they want.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, the director or producer for this film, James DeMonaco, talked frequently about looking at someone's whole body of work. He also was greatly involved with The Negotiator. Not that I'm encouraging anyone to go check that out. Kevin Spacey, Samuel L. Jackson. But that film also, pretty much, if you want to boil it down to its most simple element, is organized around a gang of whites who just happen to be the police officers, but a gang of whites going to kill one black person who also has done nothing wrong, who's been framed, but that is also a James DeMonaco project. But anywho, with your analysis of that scene where he's explaining it, I thought the same thing in terms of this is the white family, which Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., he says that is the backbone of the system of white supremacy, the white family teaching their children, this is how the system works. And we have this system, we have this night of purging, you can go out and kill black people, and even some of the language that's there, we're going to be fine. We have the money to protect ourselves. That, the general attitude, whites for the most part, we're going to be fine. It's the niggers who do not have the means to protect themselves. They're the ones that are going to bear the brunt of this, so we'll just kick back, we'll watch a movie, have fun, no big deal for us. I think it's interesting because when you were given the commentary about, you know, Ethan Hawke, we're supposed to kind of be rooting for his character. He's kind of supposed to be the good guy that the white teens that come up, they're supposed to be thought of as like the affluenza teens and the psychopaths. We're not supposed to be rooting for them, but we're supposed to be rooting for Ethan Hawke. It reminds me so much of a few of our guests, white guests that have come on the program, Zach Casey specifically, when he says the impossibility of positive white identity, meaning there is no such thing as a good white person. If you are white, you are culpable in the system of white supremacy. And I think Dr. Kevorkian, I think he saw that logic and has attested to it before on the program. But Ethan Hawke, he buys flowers. I forgot what they're called, but they're these blue flowers that you're supposed to have if you are in support of the purge. He's bought a pair. He sells security. Right. He sells security to keep white people safe from this violence so that they can hunker down and get through this 12-hour stretch and then go about their lives. That's what he does. And from what he's telling his son, it was really bad before. We had all this crime and unemployment and, you know, it works. This is what makes America great again. You don't remember what things were like when it was really bad and really out of control. And I even think some of that is hinting just because of the timing of when all of this happens. Some of that is it was really bad when we had that no good black person in the White House. But now that's over and behind us and we can move forward and things are back to normal and better for white people. Even I guess I'm kind of moving forward, but this connects. I think at some level, this film is making the first film specifically, I think, is making a commentary on white masculinity, specifically the failure of white masculinity. This film came out months after President Obama was reelected. Ethan Hawke's character is dead by the end of the film. He dies in part because they do not turn over the Negro. They don't give them what they want. He can't do it at the last minute, even though they have some really ugly moments in torturing this black male. And we're going to, you know, you've got to go out there. We can't sacrifice our white family for you. So you're going to have to die. Sorry about that, black guy. But he can't do it at the last minute. He says, no, we won't do it. And we'll just try and hunker down and get through. But he dies. I think that is important in my view. The message being conveyed there, if you are a white person, if you do not go along with the system of white supremacy, you are forfeiting your white identity. You are forfeiting your life if you do not comply and go along with this system. They come in, they kill him. And they ask him before he dies, was it worth it to sacrifice your life for this black guy? And he does not answer. I think that's huge. And I even think the way that the black guy got in their house, the white family didn't see this black guy out there struggling, being hunted by this mob of whites, young white people. In fact, they didn't see this happening. Say, oh, man, we need to get him in here. This is terrible. Charlie, the child, saw this and let this black guy in against the wishes of his family, who chastised him. Why did you do this? What did you let him in our house for? We don't know who he is. And he pulls out his gun. He's even looking like he might be ready to shoot him. I think that's significant because Charlie, in addition to being a child, Charlie is sickly. And he's kind of effeminate. He has long hair. They don't call him Charles. They call him Charlie. He looks like he's, I'd say, maybe 12, 13 years old. He's checking. He has a heart monitor on. He's got to check his vitals and what have you several times throughout the film. As things are getting increasingly dire, you hear his monitor going off, that his heart rate is increasing. He's not in good health. I think that is an allegory for some of the things that Donald Trump is speaking to. The angst of the white race, whites in this area of the world, and white men specifically, a failure of white manhood. Ethan Hawke's character, he's in security. He fails to keep his family secure. He fails to hand over the black person. He dies. They just total failure. By the end of the film, the only people that are left standing are the white wife, the white daughter, and in my view, the effeminate white son. Those are the only people that are left. The white father is dead. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think that's it's a chilling analysis that of the way that what exactly he's being punished for. I mean, there's one version of reading it where I was thinking, well, he's being punished for what he admits is his mistake, that he shouldn't have said we're going to give them what we want. But I think, you know, the way it plays out, it also makes sense to read it that other way, that he's being punished for showing weakness and not sticking, so to speak, to his guns. I mean, it's almost though. I mean, it's a failure of masculinity either way, but it's almost the case that he never really has a true change of heart. It's almost just that he doesn't catch the guy in time to go along with the wishes. Like, the son never wants him to go along with it. But as you said, there's some ugly moments, and to me, one of the ugliest is when the father, you know, is sort of saying, Here's what we have to do. He says we need to get a rope. And, you know, anytime someone says that, I mean, that is a direct invocation of the whole legacy of lynching in America, right? Which is almost always about accusing the black man of being a threat to the white woman, and then the violent lynching that takes place with the rope. So the fact that the Ethan Hawke character, in delivering this sacrificial victim, says we need to get a rope, means he's playing into that whole history of lynching. And I'll also say it's a whole history of dehumanization. I was trying to think about the way that, you know, this thing is rated. It says R for strong, disturbing violence in some language. And, you know, again, some of the most disturbing things about the movie are the what is said and how it's said. One word that resonates really throughout all the movies in the franchise, and it's used by different characters in different ways, but the use of the word pig is prevalent. I don't know if that was something that you noticed, but the young purgers that come in pursuit of this black man accuse the white family of giving sanctuary to a dirty homeless pig, and they just keep saying, why won't you give us the pig? So this is a logic whereby a human being is treated as an animal and is therefore deemed someone who could be killed. But this is another way of deeming saying that you can kill someone with impunity is if you take away their humanity and treat them as an animal. And that's language that pervades this franchise as well.
Absolutely. It reminded me of another film that we have discussed on the program before that is extremely popular, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. I think the most significant line of the film, given by Harvey Keitel, and the last vignette where they're trying to clean up Marvin after they've blown his head off, the black male, where he says,
"Nobody will be missed."
I thought they could have inserted that in the film there. In fact, even what you just said about the rope, I thought that was hugely important when Ethan Hawke's character, he says, we need to get a rope, invoking lynching. There was another moment when when these white teens, when they come to the house and says, you, for whatever reason, you've given this black guy sanctuary. They never call him black, by the way, but you've given him sanctuary. It immediately of the book Without Sanctuary, the photographic entry of lynching. I believe that's James Allen, the exhibit and the book that is talk about chilling. But it reminded me of that explicitly. And I think there's even a moment after they come and they give the initial offer. I'm about to play the initial offer when they come to the house and explain how things are going to evolve from the evening if they do not hand over this black male. But they, after they make the initial offer, they're kind of going around the house and just molesting them and tapping on the windows and what have you and saying, you know, give us, I think they even called him a pig during that point too. Like, give him up. He's worthless. He's nobody. They could have inserted the line from Pulp Fiction. Nobody who will be missed. What is the problem? Give him to us and we can all go about our evening. We'll leave you guys alone and we'll go kill this black guy and move forward. This is the initial scene where these young white teens, and I can't emphasize that enough. These are not old white people. These look like early 20s. Like if you want to think of the teen in the affluenza case, these are early 20s white men and women who are out having a grand old time. They're not ignorant. They're not poor. They brag about being well educated. And we're doing our thing. We're going out having a good time hunting a black person. I just want to hear some of the language that is used when they give this offer to get this black male who doesn't even have a name, to go to your point about dehumanization. We never even get his name in the film. He's just, I think they list him officially in the credits as stranger. And that's it. He doesn't even have a name. But this is from...
I will give him credit for this. I believe they call him Bloody Stranger.
Right. Bloody Stranger. Bloody Stranger.
So he's attribute as well as a label. So
wow.
Although I think it's somewhat important because that's how he has to be bloody for the child to perceive him as not a threat. He's initially identified as a victim because he shows up as a bloody stranger who's already been attacked. And this makes it plausible for the kid to let him in. It makes it plausible for the screenplay, for the black man not to be read as a threat, but to be read as a victim. And I think, I think they had to make him bloody stranger rather than just stranger to let him into the house. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, although there is a point where he does have a white woman grasped at gunpoint, invoking the earlier threat of black males. This is what can happen. You can let a black male in your house and your daughter can get raped or killed. So his victim status is kind of questioned, at least, but certainly I think that makes sense in terms of why Charlie felt the need to let him in the house in the first place. He had already been wounded, attacked, bloody stranger. But this is...
About letting him into the house is that I think, you know, this was meant to be played as a sympathetic moment, but in one of the commentaries I saw, I think this was in the director said this, that some audiences would express anger at this point. Like, how could that kid be so stupid? How could he do that? So it's supposed to be like he's doing a good thing, but sometimes the audience reaction was to just be angry. Like, that's a terrible thing that he's doing. How could he do that? So anyhow, I thought that was valuable to throw in.
I do as well. I am not surprised. That kind of goes back to my initial point about the failure of white masculinity. He's not a man. He's not even learning correctly how he's supposed to function as a white man. What are you doing sympathizing with this nigger, bloody or no? But this is their offer when they come to the Sandlin home. Incredible. There are quite a few terms I would say pay attention to. One of them is fair. One of them is audacity. But this is their offer to the Sandlins.
That one's saying something.
For Mrs. Sandlin? Your home tells me you're a good folk, just like us. One of the halves. And your blue flowers tell me that you support the purge. And we want to treat you fairly, so listen closely. Let me introduce us. We are some fine, young, very educated guys and gals. We've gotten gussied up in our most terrifying guises, as we do every year, ready to violate, annihilate, and cleanse our souls. But things took a turn.
Our target escaped us, and several of your dear neighbors informed us that you, the Sandmans, have inexplicably given him sanctuary. Mr. and Mrs., the man you're sheltering is nothing but a dirty homeless pig. A grotesque menace to our just society who had the audacity to fight back, killing one of us when we attempted to execute him tonight. The pig doesn't know his place, and now he needs to be taught a lesson. You need to return him to us. Alive. So that we may purge as we are entitled. Here's the plan, Sandins. You have until our provisions arrive, provisions which will help us break into your elegant home. If you don't deliver him by the aforementioned time, we'll release the beast on him and on you. And we can enter any home we want. And we will want, as wanting as our will on this fine night. Don't force us to hurt you. We don't want to kill our own. Please just let us purge. Toodaloo, Sandins.
What an illustration of white pathology, in my opinion. Trayvon Martin had the audacity to fight back as well, so I'm told. Anything stand out significant to you in that section?
Yeah, I mean, right after that phrase about the audacity to fight back, and that he didn't know his place, which is, you know, for that's a very kind of old fashioned, you might say, or traditional way of expressing racism. That's a kind of a Jim Crow era type of language. It strikes me, not that it has gone away, but I mean, that way of saying it, someone who doesn't know their place, needs to be put in line. I will say, I want to keep it an open question. What is the fate of characters in this franchise who do have the audacity to fight back? And what do they have to do to, so to speak, earn the right to survive if they do survive? Within the logic of the films. In other words, what happens to Bloody Stranger? These are sort of disgusting characters, you know, that have just been quoted who are passing judgment on him that he's a pig who needs to be purged. But on the other hand, he's someone who does manage to survive this film and make it almost all the way through the franchise. And it seems like there's a secondary thing that's going on here, which is about how a black man who might originally be coded as being too audacious can, in the eyes of the movie, be deemed worthy of survival by sort of backing down from that. It seems to me that, that there's something that he says early on to the family, where he's sort of expressing that voice of strength or that audacity where he says, I'm not going to die tonight. And I think at the moment you say, you kind of want to cheer for the guy. You want to say, yeah, that's the right attitude. Don't give in to this situation where you being painted as the victim and that it's inevitable and that you must die. He says, I am not going to die tonight. Eventually, what happens is that the character, you know, Bloody Stranger, I believe the actor is Edwin Hodge, but the character says to the family, go ahead and give me up. He says, save your children, take me outside. And that's a very different message than I'm not going to die tonight. The movie sort of gives you the idea that if he stuck with that idea of I'm not going to die tonight, he probably would have died, in a sense. But if I could back this up and put it in a frame, I'm looking at something that I learned from a book by Ed Guerrero, a book called Framing Blackness. And I've mentioned it on the show before. But he says, invariably, it is the black man who makes the sacrifice for the white characters. And what Bloody Stranger does, you know, to sort of become redeemed in the eyes of the movie or made worthy of survival is, paradoxically, he says, I'm willing to sacrifice myself for the white family rather than insist upon his own survival. And so I think that's one of the really dangerous things about the logic of all of these films. And I think this is a consistent pattern, is that black men, in order for black men in these films not to be seen as a threat, not to be seen as something that needs to be purged or be unwanted and eliminated, in order to be out of that category, they have to demonstrate a willingness for self-sacrifice. And it happens again and again in each of these films that there's a noble black character who sacrifices himself, often specifically to protect the white family or the white woman. But it certainly happens here.
Absolutely. Major reoccurring theme, and it seems to escalate as the series go on, how many times this has to happen over and over and over, how many sacrifices have to be made. White lives matter, as I've said on the program repeatedly. White lives matter. That is demonstrated in the film. I also thought it was significant when they, just the use of the term audacity, I think significant, again, this first Purge film, it came out months after President Obama was reelected. He does have a book called The Audacity of Hope, which I think is significant on some level. I think a lot of people are aware of that book, and I do think some of the white angst is directed at his presence in the White House, and I think at some level this film is responding to that without doing it explicitly, which just little things like that. Also thought the significance of them saying, we want to treat you fairly. For folks who've listened to the cows over the years, I point that word out regularly. You are white. We are white. We want to treat you as a member of the white race and how we negotiate this interaction. But if you're not going to go along and give up the nigger, then, you know, all bets are off. Sanctuary, you heard that there, and uppity. I also thought they could have inserted the term uppity in there, that this bloody stranger was uppity and not knowing his place and needed to be put down. Just, again, the pathology of whites, I think this is on display. It reminds me of many different aspects in terms of how racism, white supremacy is practiced over the years and the violence that is necessary to maintain this system. In fact, even kind of transitioning to the second film, is titled The Purge Anarchy. It was released July 18th, 2014. Once again, context of when this film came out, the second one, it came out in between the killing of Eric Garner in New York, choked to death, and the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. This film pops out 2014. Certainly, I don't think they could have known all that was going to erupt in Ferguson or even the death of Eric Garner in New York, but I certainly think that that is huge, that a film like this, the sequel, would pop out in the middle of the huge upheaval that became the summer of 2014. Before moving to that one, anything else that we should think about in terms of the first Purge film? Anything that we missed?
No, I mean, I think anything would come up, you know, as these things are played out again and again in the subsequent films. So no, I don't have anything to add.
Right on. The second one, I think we've already stated that it broadens. There are many more characters. It's much more mobile. Again, the first Purge, it's pretty much isolated to one residence, the Sandlin home. Whereas the second one, you're moving around, going to different people's residences. Lots of characters involved. You kind of start with this black family. It's a black female, her daughter, and her father. I also think it's important because you do see a lot of white married couples. I don't think you see any black married families in the film, which I think is huge in terms of what's being communicated with that idea. But you start there and you go to their residence and kind of see how things are unfolding. You have a white man in the film. He's going out to purge. He's upset. A white person was driving drunk and killed his son. He's going out to avenge his son. So that's his plan for the evening. You have a different white couple. They are thinking about getting divorced, but they're still together at the time. Their car is sabotaged. They get stuck out when the purge commences. So they're just trying to find sanctuary themselves. And all of these folks kind of converge, interestingly, as the purge evening progresses. The first clip that I snagged from the second one, this is the black female with her daughter. They're in the house and they're going to get their father and they find out he's gone. And so it unfolds. You find out where their father is. We'll get this clip and get some of Dr. Kevorkian's thoughts.
Mom! What is it? Mom, come here.
What's wrong?
Where's Papa?
Look at this.
Dearest Eva and Kelly, my greatest heartache is seeing the two girls I love so much struggling in this world. I'm dying. You know this. I'll be a martyr for a wealthy family tonight. They paid me for this service. $100,000 will be transferred into your accounts, my darlings. Take their money. Survive the night and live a safe life. I love you.
Blessed be America, the nation reborn.
I don't understand.
It's how the wealthy purge, baby. They buy poor and sick people, and they take them into their homes, and they kill them where they're safe.
Oh, my God. It's just like Carmelo said. Why would Papa do that? I don't understand why he would do that. Okay, he must have left something that could tell us where he went. Like his phone. We should call
Kelly.
His phone. We could stop him. Okay, that's fine. We can do something about this. I don't know what, but we can still do something about it.
Stop. He's gone. He's gone.
Context of white supremacy. So the second film, it is expanded to where now you just have, as opposed to going out and hunting down black people to kill, we'll just pay money and have the black person delivered to our residence, and we can kill them in our living room. Your thoughts, Dr. Kevorkian?
Well, again, just to reiterate the sort of the gap between what the film says it's about and maybe even at some level thinks it's about and what it can be seen to be about in the context that you're providing, the important historical context of violence against black men, such as the murders of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, the explanation that is given in the film, the phrase was, this is how the wealthy purge, right? So again, DeMonico and the producers, whenever they talk about this film, they are talking about the haves versus the have-nots, the growing gap between the upper class and the lower class. But again, the sacrifice that we see, how the wealthy purges, is what is depicted is the white family having purchased a non-white man. Again, this is a version of that self-sacrificing male character, that his only virtue is in his sacrifice. So the difference here is one might say that at least he's sacrificing himself for his own family in this case, but that's also an obscene requirement. That he would have to earn his nobility by sacrificing himself, by giving himself up. And I will say it is a film that's about economics, but it's about economics that consistently overlaps to show usually black men in a bad light, that you see black men on the street selling protection, we accept any kind of payment, that sort of thing. That the sort of economic imperative is played out in violent ways against specifically the black male bodies who are sort of bought into this system. But again, it says how the wealthy purge, but that's not what's shown. What's shown is a racialized sacrifice.
Also, one question I forgot to ask. I'll get it as even though we're transitioning on the second film. Do you think they could have made the first Purge film if Bloody Stranger was white?
Huh. Wow. Huh. It would be a completely different film, right? I mean, that's the right question to ask if you're going to say, is it just about economics? Is it just about the rich and the poor, right? No, it would change it entirely. I'm not saying it couldn't be made, but we would have a different franchise on our hands then.
I don't know the audience reaction, if you would be hearing people saying, oh my gosh, why did Charlie open the door if it was a wounded white person who was saying, hey, I need help. I didn't do anything. They're trying to kill me. Please, I need help. And Charlie complies and opens to allow him some sanctuary. I don't think you would have a whole lot of white people saying, oh man, I can't believe the stupid kid. What did he do that for? I thought that was important too, because I thought about that a few times myself, and I just it was as inconceivable as me thinking of them making the Breaking Bad franchise if Walter White was a black person. I just have a very difficult time thinking how that would work, and certainly not being the same reaction from viewers. Exact same thing in terms of the sacrifice that has to be made in this film. I even thought. And for people who've seen the sequel, The Purge Anarchy, that so the father, he willingly sacrifices himself. His daughters are supposed to get $100,000, I think, each for him being allowing these whites to kill him, slaughter them in their home. They have a really grotesque picture where they have all this plastic covering their residence so they don't spill any of this nigger's blood on their, you know, couch or what have you. And it's the same thing. These are refined whites for that argument where there are racists, but they're just poor white trash. They're ignorant. They don't know any better. Whereas that is nonsense. And it's consistently showing this image of whites who are very educated, have a lot of wealth, and they are participating too in this anti-black violence. His daughters, the father who's going to be killed, his daughters are supposed to get some money from this. They end up being targeted by these goons that are going out with government sanction, it seems, and getting specific people to bring them so that they too can be purged and killed. And you later find out that they have been targeted specifically. They go into an apartment building and they're looking for specific residents, two of the folks being the black male's daughter who has, you know, sacrificed himself to be killed. And I even thought that, wow, like that could be an elaborate part of this scheme. Like we get people who, for whatever reason, they say, okay, hey, if you give our family members some money, we will allow you to kill us and at least they will benefit. And then we say, well, hey, we can kill them and then we'll go kill the people that they're supposed to give the money to. So then we don't even have to give them any money. We can just purge all of them and, hey, we win all the way around. I kind of thought that as the film proceeds, because it does seem like that's kind of what happens. There seems to be also an element of, I think it's really just the anti-black element of this. I think that's really important. There seems to be, and it's certainly a major facet of the third film, but in the second one, Latino-black conflict. These two black females, they're left after the father is gone. It's, I think, almost immediately once they discover that, oh man, father is not just gone, but he's killed. He's been killed. This Diego, who is a non-white male, I think he's coded as quote-unquote Latino. He breaks into their residence. He's upset. We've seen him before in the film where he's kind of inebriated. He's got a bottle of, you know, alcohol in his hand. He's kind of propositioning the mom to take him with her upstairs for protection. And she just kind of blows him off to go about her business. So he comes in and he feels, again, uppity. You've been uppity. You've been rude to me and looking down at me. And it's my night. I think you talked about before. It is my right. It is my entitlement to purge. And so I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm going to rape you. I'm going to rape your daughter and whatever else I want to do because it's my right. And then these government sanctioned goons, they burst in and kill Diego. But there's certainly, at least to me, there seems to be some element of Latino black conflict that is inserted into the film that gets much bigger in the third element. Did you see that aspect there?
I guess I hadn't thought about those races being played against one another. I mean, I definitely saw Diego as being set up explicitly as this predatory non-white male, not black, but Mexican-American, but definitely being set up as one of these people that is seen as a justified victim of purging. So that's what I saw in him. That he's made to show the kinds of behaviors that target him as an unwanted element. And so it's another one of the sort of the mixed messaging. Like, you're supposed to root against the government goons, but on the other hand, you see the government goons coming in and putting down Diego, you know, you'd use that term, you know, because he's already been set up in this animalistic way that killing him looks justified. So you're supposed, you know, it the mixed message is, yeah, the government goons are supposed to be the bad guys, but here they're taking out someone who has been identified as a threat in a recognizable racially coded way.
What would your response be if people pushed back and to any notion that this film is encouraging white supremacy and particularly anti-black violence? If they say, hey, when these goons come in and they snatch these two black females and they take them out and they're going to be purged as well, it is a white man, Sergeant, who comes to save the day. This is the same white man who's going to avenge the death of his son. He's going to go kill the white drunk driver who killed his son. But he sees this. He doesn't want to get involved. He's kind of talking to himself like, I don't want to get involved. I got my own purge plans for the evening. Just you can't save anybody. Just let them be. But he does intervene and he kills most of these goons and he rescues these two black females and the white couple, the white male and the white female who got stranded when their car was sabotaged. What would your response be to say, hey, there's a white savior and he comes in and he saves these two black females. So it can't be that this film is supporting white supremacy.
I mean, again, it's still then it has to be the white hero at the center of it, which is the most, you know, traditional Hollywood, you know, script of all. I mean, that's, you know, if I've analyzed nothing else, it's how everything in these action movies exists to make to the glory of the white male action hero. So, you know, if you said that the first film was about the failure of white masculinity, This in the Frank Grillo, that character you have then, something like the appearance of the redemption of white masculinity. Even if that is being played out against, you know, with him visiting violence against the white supremacist government. It's still, you know, the flip side of it, just as you say, you know, could you make the first one if Bloody Stranger was white? You know, could you make the second one if the Frank Grillo, you know, ex-policeman, could you make that movie if he was black? It would seem to be the symmetrical question. But yeah, I mean, there are people who react. I mean, it's possible to react a lot of different ways to these films and in lots of very dangerous ways, but there are people, maybe we'll get to the third, but there are people, you know, I saw online postings about the third film that had taglines like, this is very racist. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I'd see how they're analyzing the racism. And then what is claimed in those analyses is that it's racist against white people. You know, and it's true that you know, I think in both of these first two movies, there are white supremacists that are portrayed in very unappealing lights, that are portrayed as obscene and disgusting. But still, somehow, the spectacle of the purge that they are making possible is overall something that is being passed off as an acceptable form of entertainment, that it tries to give the audience other reasons to buy into this story and to say, I'm not really cheering for that, when that is, in a sense, the main event, the main bloody spectacle of the thing, is the violence being done by those white supremacists. And then you sort of have the bonus of the second wave, when there's the justified killings of those perpetrators. So you get to sort of have the blood sport all over again. But that, to me, never erases the idea that you're being sold a whole bill of goods as blood sport entertainment. That's somehow all to be accepted. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. How do you read? Because you do have, a counter resistance force in the second film, Carmelo and his band of mostly black people, and they have their berets, kind of a nod to the Black Panthers or some such black organization, but they are resisting the new founding fathers. They hack into a lot of the video propaganda to put out their own messages against the purge and saying that we're going to fight back. And they do fight back, and they come and kill quite a few whites later on in the film. What is your reading of Carmelo and this group of rebels?
Yeah, I mean, in the clip that you played, Carmelo was invoked. I think Lainey says, you know, it's like Carmelo says. She's quoting him, so you know that she's sort of, as I said, I think the moral center of this film. She's one who's even there to kind of save the soul of the white man, the Frank Grillo character. When ultimately at the end of the movie, she dissuades him from pursuing his act of vengeance. And she's someone who finds great appeal in Carmelo Johns. And, yeah, I mean, I thought he was a very, very interesting character. It made me wonder, really, my big question, you know, for the third one, what happened to Carmelo Johns? You never hear of him again. But he definitely is one of those characters who, I don't know, to me, struck me as having that kind of genuine audacity of hope in the good way. I think that's a brilliant connection that you make, I thought he had some very powerful things to say in critique of the purge. And I thought it wasn't the case that he was undercut the way you often see black militants being undercut in the movies. I'm trying to remember where we've talked about this. I think we talked about it in maybe The Bank Job. This was quite a while ago, where there might be a character that might appear to be, a black militant, but ultimately is shown to be corrupt or not serious or not politically committed. And it seems like Carmelo Johns is a completely sincere and authentic character. I don't know. Did you have a critique of Carmelo?
It's difficult. I felt like he was almost inserted as a straw man. If you're going to have this, and you're going to have, when you know it's predictable who's going to bear the brunt of the purge, it's going to be black people, that you're going to have a resistance. And as I said, I think this is a direct commentary to white supremacy. And this comes out literally like weeks before the eruption in Ferguson. You know this is going to happen. We've got this. Black people are going to be dying left and right. Doesn't matter who it is, Sandra Bland, Eric Garner, Miriam Carey, this is going to happen every day, all day long, worldwide. We know that they're going to get upset. We know that there are going to be some Fergusons every now and then. There are going to be some Baltimores every now and then where they get upset and they fight back, black people, victims of white supremacy. We know this is going to happen. So they include that, but that it's not extended. Like, you get to see Frank Grillo's character throughout the film, and he even comes back in the third one. So you get to see there's a lot to critique, to analyze. There's not very much of Carmelo's character. Even when Bloody Stranger, when he reappears briefly in the second one, he's only there for a very limited amount of time. You still don't get a name from him. And really the time that you see them, I think the first time that you actually get to see them live, they are coming to save white people. Now, the two black females are there too, but it's mostly a group of white people. They come, they save them, they kill some other white people to extract the group that they have protected, and that's kind of it. You don't really see them anymore. Most of the time when you see Carmelo's character, it's just a video of somebody watching him on a computer screen or on a television where he's speaking against the Purge for a very limited amount of time. So I feel like they don't really flesh his character out. I feel like that is probably deliberate. That's why you don't see him in the third one. But I feel like it's making a straw man of the resistance that they know is going to be there in a system of white supremacy, whether it pops up as Minister Malcolm X, Assata Shakur, the Black Panthers, or the Black Lives Matter and people that were protesting in Ferguson and New York about Eric Garner and these different incidents. They know that's going to happen. They incorporate it into the film. And I would even add, just from what I've seen from a lot of white people with the events that have happened real world, Ferguson and that sort of thing, the response to Carmelo Jones is pretty similar to the response to Black Lives Matter. These folks need to be purged. This is a terrorist organization, and this is just further justification why this group of people, blacks, they are a menace. They need to be cleansed. They're just a nuisance and a problem. I don't know how white audiences would respond to Carmelo Jones and that organization, but that's what it, my brain computer, that's kind of the analysis that I came to, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think it's a hugely important point that you make, that he is from the beginning and predominantly framed by being on a website. He's allowed to speak a certain amount of truth, but he's not a physical threat. He's on the website.
Color monitors. Insert color monitors.
So I'm sorry. I had to step on that line there. But yeah, that's right. I mean, what he's, he says some. He says some compelling things. You know, he says we've lost our souls to attain this peace. We no longer worship at the altar of Christ, Muhammad, Yahweh. We worship at the altar of Smith and Wesson. We the people know not what we do. And I think it's a very powerful way that he speaks to this sort of this betrayal of everything that is could possibly be good in cultural traditions, and giving it up to this violent purging fantasy. I guess, I don't know if this is a side note, but you made the contrast, yes, to the Frank Grillo character being there physically all the time. And so, yeah, I think he is a counterpoint to that the real action heroism goes to the Frank Grillo's character. I want to quote one thing that Frank Grillo said in an interview, which I thought was potentially interesting. He said about this film, he said, it's about violence and prejudice. And it's about what we do to the less privileged. And I thought it was very interesting that he used that word prejudice. I know that you prefer, stronger terms like racism and white supremacy, but I thought that was almost as close as anyone involved in the film got to saying that there is a dimension of racial prejudice that's being talked about in these films. Because otherwise, it was pretty much a party line that's about the rich versus the poor. But the actor, when he's talking about how he sees what's going on in these, he says, yeah, this is about prejudice. This is, and not only is it about prejudice, but it's a reflection of what is going on in the world.
How could you? I almost feel like I've stated this for years. White people are not ignorant about racism. I don't think white people, for the most part, I don't think that they have to explicitly communicate with other whites and say, oh yeah, this is a commentary on racism. This is something where we want you to think about. They don't have to do that. If you are white, I think it's just assumed that you already know what the deal is. You already know what the dominant motivating force on the planet is. You already know your identity as a white person and how you are supposed to function as a member of the global white collective. So you don't need any of that. You can just go and you'll see. In fact, lead into the clip. Second sound clip. This is from The Purge Anarchy, second installment. This is closer to the climax of the film. When you have a scene like this, I cannot imagine you being a white person and not being able to connect the dots in terms of the subtext of what this film is really about. I don't even think I need to say anything for the audience. If you haven't seen the film, it'll still make sense. There's an auction. I'll just leave it there. An auction. This is towards the end of The Purge Anarchy, which again released in 2014.
What an impressive plot, isn't it? Ladies and gentlemen, since this is the last purge of the evening, the entry price will be $200,000. Mr. Lockhart and his wonderful wife, Lauren. Fantastic. The Hanover sisters. Ah! I've been waiting all evening for your participation. Fantastic. And I assume you brought your signature blades. All right, one spot left. Anyone else? Mr. Hurst? Oh, wonderful. And will your handsome sons be joining you? Ladies and gentlemen, this will be Charles and Tom's first. I am so happy that you have this to share together. Oh, and one last reminder. The weapons rack is stocked with the latest and the greatest. And my personal favorite is the Mauser Elite SSX double barrel. It has a delicate trigger and the smoothest discharge. It is so precise. It's as if God handcrafted it himself. Well, that will do it. Purgers, please suit up. Good luck. Good luck. We'll see you shortly on the hunting grounds.
Get up, get up, get up!
Again, an auction near the climax of the Purge. Your thoughts, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I mean, what can you say about that? It's definitely, you know, on the one hand, it's showing these characters at their most disgusting, it's almost too over the top to the point where it runs the risk of being able to say, oh, the world isn't really like that. But then the reality of the auction then grounds it in the real history of the ugliest things about America. The slave auction, right? So this is showing this impulse of the Purge as a continuation of that slave-based economy.
And again, in my view, that sort of subtext in terms of what this is talking about and the history of violence, systemic violence against Black people that has been celebrated, mandated, government-sanctioned violence against Black people. I just don't think that the typical white person, you would connect the dots. I don't know how you would miss that. And that's kind of the thing that I mean when I say that I don't think that for whites. In fact, we reference, I think, one of Josh Wickett. I think he is often quotes the film Fight Club, where the first rule of racism is you don't talk about racism. So you don't have to explicitly say that we are messaging about white supremacy racism in a film like this. You can just present it, and typical white person, if they are informed, if they have half a brain, I think they'll connect most of the dots in seeing this film and the thought process that they're supposed to walk away from when you have an auction, when you have a nameless Black person being hunted, just everything that gets presented throughout these films. I think you will be able to do the math and figure out what it is and what message you're supposed to have as a white woman, white man, member of the global white minority. I guess before going to the third and final film in the installment, I thought it was important. I think you touched on this before, that they kind of give you a reveal at the end of the film when the the white male is going to avenge his son's death. Sergeant is his name in the film. When he's going to avenge his son's death and he changes his mind, has a moment of moral clarity, and he leaves, and then he gets shot by one of these government goons who's been out doing these kidnappings and purgings throughout the evening. He comes back and he's going to kill him. But before he does, he said that there wasn't enough purging taking place. So we had to step in to aid to get the killings up. I thought that was significant. And you even touched on that earlier in saying that they, in the first film, that they said unemployment was at 1%. And in the second film, they said it was at 5%. So it's, we need to do a little bit more killing so that we can get those unemployment numbers down. The significance of them making that a part of the climax, the conclusion of that film, saying that the government is getting involved to make sure that we have an adequate amount of killing taking place?
Yeah, I mean, and they even use the term government supplements, right, to make it very euphemistic and official sounding, government supplements to the killing. And on the one hand, the brutality of that character, I think he's called Big Daddy. So again, all of these images of paternalism, the new founding father, this butcher-like character, Big Daddy, he's got like the apron on and the big machine gun shooting out of the back of the truck. These are all sort of grotesque images of a violent paternal system. I think it's a movie that, kind of wants to have it both ways. So it portrays sort of the appeal, the sick appeal of this idea of purging, touting its economic necessity and its virtues. On the other hand, then the audience is treated to Sargent sort of fighting back. He's like sort of supposed to be the good white masculinity against this grotesque white masculinity. But ultimately, it's all on parade, and again, it's all being sold to you as entertaining and acceptable slaughter, and even sold as necessary slaughter.
I can quote, I think he might be listening now. Mr. Nero has called in a few times before when you were a guest on the program. I think one of his seminal lines over the years, white people kill for fun. I think this would probably be the best illustration of why he makes that comment on a regular basis, and seeing it reflected in the system of white supremacy, in my view, all the time, would be a film like this. And again, the popularity, this film, by the time the most recent film has only been out a few weeks, I don't even think it's been out a month yet. This film is already close to having grossed $100,000 by the time it's done. This film will have grossed this franchise will have grossed over $300,000. Not that I think that's the most important aspect of the film, but I do think that that is significant. Third film, July 4th, was released this weekend, and not just released July 4th weekend. This film was released days, literally days, before the killing of Philando Castile in Minnesota, the killing of Alton Sterling in Louisiana, and the shootings in Dallas, Texas. The reported five officers were killed, as well as the alleged sniper, Micah Xavier Johnson. This film came out days before that, and there were even comments in Louisiana saying that there was going to be some sort of revenge purge against the Louisiana Police Department, the Baton Rouge Police Department, because of the shooting of Alton Sterling. Some of the reports, they debunked that and said this was just a rumor and, people were just talking nonsense or what have you. But that did even come up briefly, even though I don't think I heard anyone saying, well, maybe having a film like this encouraged some of the violence that took place within days of this film being released. I think that's important for context of the release, and then also the campaign, Make America Great, with a lot of the symbolism that you see in this franchise. I think one of the more significant scenes in this film, it's at the very beginning of the film. I think this is like the day before the purge commences, where they have this scene. They have the character Joe. He's a black male. He owns like a small shop. In this town, for listeners, this character is the black male who played Bubba in Forrest Gump. where they end up having Bubba Gump shrimp. This is the same actor who played Bubba in Forrest Gump, where he is Joe in this film, and he has like a small store. So we have Joe, Lainey, who is a black female. She's a former gang member. Joe also is a former Crip member, by the way. They have a black male patron in the store and a Latino male, where Marco, where he works there as well. And they're just kind of all having a casual conversation about a white female senator. She is running on a campaign of ending the Purge. The film opens with her family being killed on Purge night. She's the only survivor. And so she gets into politics. She's running for president, and her campaign is she's going to end the Purge. So they've just seen her debating on television, and then they're talking about their thoughts on her and just their thoughts about life in general. I think this is one of the more important scenes in the whole franchise. In fact, it's about a minute long. We'll get that and get Dr. Kevorkian's thoughts.
As she's done many times before, Senator Roan broke security protocol, walking off the stage.
Tell you this much. Stepping into the audience. She got them little titties, but she got some big-ass balls. She ain't got a snowball's chance in a steam bath of winning this thing, but she be taking on them old white-haired George Washington wannabe mofos all by herself. And to that, I say bully for her.
Oh, horseshit. She's full of it, too. Nothing will ever change.
Hey, Lainey, I think we've offended Marcos with our anti-senator talk.
The senator's going to win. She's going to make real changes, too. You'll see. All she needs is Florida. She gets the 29 electoral votes from Florida. That puts her over 270. She can do it.
Smart ass. All that useless shit. You can't butter a damn bagel correctly.
I can butter your bagel, boss.
Oh, you butter my bagel. Well, you got jokes over there. Yeah, you just be careful, kid, with all that hope, because it can be a bad thing. Hope can lead to a lot of letdown. Tell him, Irish Eye.
Excuse me, what? I'm not paying attention. I'm thinking about waffles and pussy. That's all I ever really think about, actually.
Irish Eye, ladies and gentlemen.
Fuck, you're laughing at me. I'm dead serious.
Wow. And again, this is happening, I think it's about a day before the purge commences in the film. Anything significant stand out in that section of the film, Dr. Kevorkian?
Actually, I'd like to hear your comments on that, if I may ask, and kick that back to you.
For sure. I still will. I generally, if I was talking to a white person, I would not allow them to throw a question back, but I will concede this time. Man. I'm going to quote Earl Butz, if I may. And if we have children, I do encourage folks to have their children listen to the cows. In fact, nothing stood out to you initially about that scene, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, what stood out to me was the political commentary. I mean, it seems like there's a potential for real truth telling in Lainey's character, that there's three things. You know, that Joe has some sort of faith in this politician, but Lainey is going to still be skeptical. And she's saying, I don't believe yet that this woman really cares. And, you know, over the course of the movie, you see that, you know, along those lines, that it is consistently a case of white lives matter in this particular film, that her survival becomes preeminent. And it's sold under the idea that, well, she's an important politician, so we have to save her. But if you press more closely on it, the logic of that does not really hold up. So I found myself, for one thing, respecting Lainey's skepticism there. What else are we wanting to highlight here?
Let's see. For anyone who listens to the cows, you can insert Dr. Kamau Kamban.
Our people are very serious about not being very serious.
You can
I mean, the whole thing about I wasn't paying attention, or that, you know, and sort of, yeah, kind of clownish and, you know, distracted speech about only being interested in food and sex. I mean, these are very negative stereotypes that are being enacted there very casually, and in a way that, you know, that this early in the film, it tells you sort of what the values are that are going to be expected. It's like one time when we were going to talk about what was the film As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson and, you know, Cuba Gooding Jr. And really the only thing we had to talk about was like the first 30 seconds of the film when Jack Nicholson is just making these slurs about molasses and whatnot, and just sort of the casual stereotyping and racism of it, that tells you everything you needed to know about what the values of that film were going to be.
Absolutely. People are about to die. Literally, they are about 24 hours. A whole lot of people are going to die, and a whole lot of people that look like the people that are in this conversation. It's you all that are going to be in the most danger in about 24 hours. And I mean, literally, he gets a phone call. It's, you know, minutes have passed in the movie, but he gets a phone call that they're canceling his insurance. His whole livelihood and life are now in jeopardy. And this is the conversation that they're having literally hours before all of this killing is about to take place. That's one. Particularly the scene or the commentary that they give about Irish Eyes, where he gives his mantra about what he wants, what's important to him. I was reminded of Earl Butz. Earl Butz is the former Secretary of Agriculture under Richard Nixon, since his name has been invoked a lot over the past couple months. He was also in the Ford administration. He lost his job. He was forced to resign. He was on an airplane. He was talking with some other white people, and they asked him, why aren't there more black people in the Republican Party? Now, this is in the 1970s, but that's also a refrain I've heard a lot through the years. So they ask him, why aren't there more black members of the Republican Party? And he says, well, you know what the coloreds want. And the guy says, no, I don't know. And he says, well, I'll tell you. And this is a direct quote. This was in Time magazine. I'm not editing it because I think that's part of the problem with white supremacy, is too much gets edited. It just needs to be clear about what was said. So former Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz, white man, he says, I'll tell you what the coloreds want. It's three things. First, a tight pussy. Second, loose shoes. And third, a warm place to take a shit. All direct quote from the former Secretary of Agriculture, who was forced to resign his position. That, in my view, that is what whites think of black people. That's what you are supposed to think about black people, why black people should be purged. And I think to insert that in a film where a white person isn't saying that about black people, but you can just give that those lines over to the black people and have them say that I just want waffles and sex and I'll be great. I think that massive in terms of reinforcing how we are to think about black people and why it totally a-okay. Go out and these folks deserve to be purged. They're totally worthless. They have no value at all. White lives matter. Certainly no one like these folks talking the way that they do. I think the hopelessness is also important as well, because we talked about that before. And Joe, this total hopelessness thing where he tells Marcos, this Latino male, hope is dangerous. When you have expectations or thinking that things could improve or be better, that there could be some positive changes for us, that is dangerous. This notion of just totally giving up, this is just what it is, it's always going to be messed up, it's not going to be any better. And if you even get into the realm where you're thinking there could be an improvement in your quality of life or some quality changes for you, that that's just setting you up for total disappointment and disaster. that sort of low ambition, I think that is widely promoted for black people to think that way in the system of white supremacy, that this system cannot be challenged, defeated. It's going to be here forever. So all you can do is just kind of make your peace with it and be comfortable. I'll pause there. Does that seem logical at all in terms of what you heard in that scene?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the reasons I wanted to gross, that what I wanted to underline was the potential of alertness on Lainey, who's sort of not having that. But I think it's important there to say that you're absolutely right, that even what she says plays into that spirit of hopelessness of the whole thing. And he'll later say, you know, I lost my faith in the system a long time ago and things like that. But yeah, it's another way to put it is, unlike some of the other characters, this is someone who, this character Joe in this self-portrayal does not have the danger of the audacity of hope, right? He is the character that's going to, you know, there's no friction for this character. There's no threat from this character, and this scene establishes that. I mean, it's interesting. Again, there's lots of mixed messaging about his identity. You know, he is a small business owner. He is self-sufficient. He's made a life for himself. In one of the interior shots of the store, you can see behind him, he's got on the wall, he's got pictures of Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois and another couple of faces that look like they're obscured. So he's someone who's sort of thought about the history of Black leadership, of people who really did have the audacity to hope. But, I mean, this is a film, you know, that it talks a lot about soul in the abstract, and the white, you know, center character is saying we're fighting for the soul of America. But there's just not a lot about the souls of Black folk in here that is presented or taken seriously, despite those icons being there briefly and shown in this store.
Very well said. Souls of Black folks are not relevant in this film at all, unless they are serving the interest of protecting, preserving white life. I also thought it was significant as well, like within that first, I think, 5 to 10 minutes when you get the store in there. I'll make sure we try to get as many of the callers in who have questions and what have you as possible to get through the third portion of the film, where the presentation of Black people, I think, just that 5 minutes or 10 minutes where you see all of these characters, I think that is, it reinforces so much of the worthlessness, the absence of Black souls. You have Joe, who you learn much later in the film, is a former gangbanger, Crip member that he acknowledges. You have Lainey, also a former gang member, which, in fact, her nickname is Pequeña Muerta, Little Murder. That's what she was called. You have Irish Eyes, who's given his worldview about what matters to him, waffles and sex. And then you have these two Black children who come into the store, and they're shoplifting and being very vile, vulgar, threatening Joe, the store owner, when he comes and tries to be very kind to them. You've been caught shoplifting, and I don't want to call the police. Let's try and handle this, you know, as calmly as we can. And they're just rude, and I'll accuse you of rape, and you better get away from me. And they're cursing at him and the whole nine. It's just worthlessness of Black people. Nothing about them is redeeming. Again, these are folks who deserve to be purged. There's no value in their life at all, in their existence. We should just get them out of here. I think that is huge to start a film like that in this way. And I thought I saw the photos on the wall as well. I think it was Malcolm X, Dr. King. I think George Washington Carver, I think, was one. I didn't get to see the other photo. It looked like it was obscured. I think even Marcus Garvey might have been one. I had to go back and double check. It's kind of a distant shot, but you can definitely make out Dr. King and Malcolm X. But I thought that was huge. But even fast forwarding a little bit in the story, I think those pictures are down by the end of the film when the shop gets looted later on, probably by Black people, because those are the people that, you know, are depicted as being the ones who are coming to attack and take down the store. But I thought that was a huge aspect of the film. We already touched on the murder tourism aspect. When the two children, these are two Black females, they come to shoplift, they get caught. Lainey makes them give the candy back and apologize. They leave. When the purge comes, they come to the store. I mean, they are drenched in blood. They have like a chainsaw, a shotgun with, again, the imagery of the American flag. They're coming to loot Joe's store. And Lainey saves the day. She stops them, but she like runs these children over in the street with her vehicle. And then she like blows one of them's brains out. She shoots all of them, kills all of them in the street. And I just thought, wow, like you were talking about before, this is one of the moments where you can cheer, right? Because I think you like Joe's character. He saves the senator. He saves these white people. So you don't want to see him harmed. But you are literally cheering for black children being not just killed, like in the most ran over with a car and then your brains blown out in the street. This is against black children in the backdrop of everything that's happened over the past 2 years. What are your thoughts on that?
I actually thought the portrayal of those shoplifters from start to finish and the way that they're treated was maybe the most disturbing thing in the whole franchise. It was just deeply upsetting to see them set up in that way. I mean, there are many characters in these films that are set up as being unlikable, but the way that this film goes out of the way to make the audience, you know, see these young women in a negative light and to see their deaths as justified and you know, portrayed in some positive way, that to me, it was the most just manipulative, destructively manipulative thing about that I saw. I mean, it's sort of hard to pick a low point, but that was the thing that upset me the most. The way it was so blatant, the way they were being set up. You know, they put in details that they earlier in the night they killed their parents. So again, maybe that was like, you know, you mentioned that you never see black families. Right, you never see a black and white married couple. You never see a black married couple. You see a white married couple. You never see a black married couple. But here, the only illusion there ever was that there was some sort of, family. Then you're being told that these young girls had killed this young girl killed her parents, and then she just goes on and on. And you should have let me take the candy. So it just portrays her as in this ridiculous light. But also, you know, again, then making, the executioner Belaney is just adds to making it, you know, upsetting, sort of destructive and self-destructive character. I'll just say another way that, you know, that's their point at which the word pig comes up again. They call Joe a pig. So they've sort of stepped into the role of the obscene young white educated characters in the first film who come up and refer to Bloody Stranger as a pig. And so you know that they're being set up as the people you're not supposed to like. But here there's just a really different hateful feeling to the way that they're being set up by calling Joe a pig.
I think one of the members of their group, I think it's two shoplifters originally, but by the time they come back to loot the shop during the purge, now they have two or three additional people with them. One of them is actually in a pig costume to just make sure that you got it, that you're not supposed to see these individuals as human beings, black children. And even I think they magnify that more because the first time you see them, they're in their school uniforms, like they go to some private school where they have their skirts on to make it really clear that these are teenagers going to school. That's the way that you should think of them, even though they're shoplifting, they're looting Michael Brown, if you will. But then later on when they come back to purge, it's, oh yeah, we want to cheer and see them killed. And you do. They oblige. This film, and you have the same trope in terms of the only black life that is valuable is willing to sacrifice for white life. And I mean, it's super magnified, multiplied in this film because it happens over and over and over. Black people putting their lives on the line or even dying in service to protect white people. And this white woman, the senator, whether it's her, whether it's Sargent's character, just repeatedly, we got to go out and protect these white. We don't even know them. And they're kind of rude and nasty to us. They don't even trust us. And we're still putting our life on the line. Joe even sacrifices his shop. I think Marcos at one point when they kind of have to make the decision, are you going to stay and protect your black business? Are you going to go and protect these white people? And he says, hey, The senator, she popped up here. Let's just take care of her. We can come back and you know, we'll get to your business later. You know, we got to protect these white people. And Joe's like, fine, all right. And they go and protect the white people while his business is going to be, you know, looted, destroyed, burned to the ground or whatever they do to it. But just that it happens so many times. What specifically do you think is being conveyed? Or is that the point? Just that if the only black lives that are worthy are going to be in service to white people.
That's consistent from the first film on, from the moment when Buddy Stranger says, no, give me up and save your family. That's how he is marked as being, you know, okay. And he gets to survive until this movie, when he is one of those many characters now named Dante Bishop, still played by Edwin Hodge, who steps into line of fire and takes a bullet for the senator. And you have, you know, again, Joe, he was willing to risk his life for his business, but then he's willing to leave protecting his business just for the life of this senator. And at one point, you know, he even faces down Dante Bishop's guys. You know, here's Dante Bishop, someone who's created this safe space under the city, you know, which is a sort of a refuge and where triage and medical treatment is taking place. These are people who are really working for peace and justice, but Joe is willing to face them down. Again, sort of another scene where, you know, blacks are pitted against blacks and a face down.
We have a sound clip of that one, because I think that's one of the few times, I think, in the entire franchise where they make it explicitly racial. Just not to interrupt you, but to give the sound clip so you can continue. But, I mean, they make it blatant, I think.
Now, I'm going to tell you right now, I like black people, but I ain't going to let y'all shoot these white folks. These are our white people, okay? So let's put them down.
You were saying, Dr. Kevorkian.
No, that's what I was saying, yes. Exactly that quotation right there. These are our white people. And really he's saying, you know, I am there, black person, I am there to sacrifice myself for them. And again, he doesn't survive the movie either. The white people do. And there's another interesting kind of illogic to this about how important it is that the white woman, the senator Roan, survive. As you say, I mean, she also is someone who immediately when she's interacting with Dante Bishop, who is sort of this justice crusader from, you know, creating the space under the city, she speaks very disrespectfully to him. She immediately assumes that sort of she can tell him what to do and how things are going to be. I mean, he's created this whole world of resistance, and immediately she thinks that she can kind of commandeer it and take charge and say how things are going to go. But one of the things she keeps saying is, you know, we can't kill the opponent, right? We can't kill that the evil minister guy. And she keeps saying we can't kill him because that would make him into a martyr, and then they'd win. Right. Well, if that's true, then nothing bad could happen from. I mean, couldn't? Why is it not also true that if the bad guy succeeded in killing her, why wouldn't she then become a martyr and then the cause of being against the purge? Why wouldn't that triumph even more? But you know, in the smaller version, action and logic of it, still she's the white woman. She must be saved, and the black lives are there to put themselves on the line for her. I will say there's an interesting moment of the Dante Bishop group having and asserting a kind of autonomy because they have a plan in place to take out the opposition. They know that the opposition is corrupt and they're going to have this murder mass, and they see an opportunity to take out this evil leader of the purge group, and the senators tell him, no, you can't do that. But ironically, I mean, Dante Bishop does not obey her order. And it's only because he acts out his plan as he had it that she is ultimately saved. So in a way, what might be termed his his disobedience then becomes redeemed because it ultimately puts him in the place where he's still going to be able to put his life on the line for him, for her. So supposedly he acted on his own, but in the overall logic of the movie, he takes those actions which ultimately allow him to make the sacrifice for her.
Hmm. Absolutely. When the portion where she is confronting Dante, who is Bloody Stranger from the first Purge, and he's been briefly in the second one, this band of, again, black people that are organizing against the Purge, and she tells them, no, you can't be violent. You have to be nonviolent. It reminded, we just had Norm Stamper on the program. He's the former chief of the Seattle Police Department, and he admits, like, you know, I was a police officer for 30 years. He referred to his nightstick as a nigger knocker. He said that's how he was trained as an enforcement officer. He was told by his white supervisor, get your nigger knocker, go get a black person. We're going to beat him down and take him to jail for nothing. That was the culture at the time, that he harassed people and all of this. Like he's written about it in his book, Breaking Rank. He talks about this openly. He said that in order to deal with the problem of police terrorism against black people, you have to be nonviolent. And I said, well, wait a minute. If you get to use your nigger knocker and bash black people in and arrest them and all the other things that happen and have happened for years and years and years, how is it then that you get to tell the black people, victims of white supremacy, how they get to respond? How do you get to dictate their response when this problem has not been solved? If they should get the nigger knocker and decide, well, I am going to inflict some violence in order to get this problem solved. How do you claim some sort of moral authority or white authority or whatever it is to say that you have to be nonviolent in going about solving this problem? It sounds exactly the same. And again, them not saying that, but the stipulation has to be that if black people are going to respond to the injustice that is meted out to them by the white global minority, we have to dictate the parameters of their response. Like, it is not acceptable for you to think independently. It's not acceptable for you to be violent unless we dictate that this is okay and unless we're in charge. And even as you stated, when Dante's group, when they do go ahead with their autonomous plan of counterviolence against the new founding fathers that's in the church, it still ends up being in service to whites because they are rescuing the senator to get her to freedom and Sarge and some of the other folks that are there. But it still ends up being to protect white people. And I think it's after they do this, that's when that clash happens between Joe, the store owner, black store owner, where he tells them, you know, you better put your guns down. These are our white people. But he doesn't say I love black people. He says I like black people, but these are our white folks. He's only known them for like a couple of hours. it's amazing on many levels in terms of the only black people that get some level of value in the film, how they have to behave in terms of supplicating themselves to the system of white supremacy, and including, as you stated, Joe doesn't make it out of this film. He literally steps in the path of a bullet to save this white woman. And that's it for Joe. And Dante as well doesn't make it out of this film, does the same thing, literally steps in the path of a bullet to save the white man, Sarge, before he has his epic battle with like the key white power goon. In all of this, I guess one last question I'll get in before I get some of the callers. They've been itching. I'm sure they have lots of commentary. What do you make of the kind of climax of the third film in the Purge installment? It being there in a church. I think Senator Roan, at the very beginning when she's having the debate, presidential debate, she says, is this, you know, the religion of murder? Is that what this is? They're having their debate when he says, yeah, I'm one of the new founding fathers and I'm going to be at the mass where we will be purging. We will be cleansing our sins, killing people. They then show you the scene at the mass where they have the victims who are going to be killed. These are white people, but they're going to kill them. I thought it was not a coincidence. Important that this film came out July fourth weekend this year, almost a year to the Charleston church shooting, with the violence that was meted out in Mother Emanuel AME Church down in Charleston last summer by Dylann Roof. Blatant act of purging. That's what he said he was going to do, purging, killing black people. Any significance there, or am I reading too much?
No, I think that's great. I mean, what you're seeing, I mean, it's under the trappings of religion, but it's also violence being done to religious tradition, just as there was violence done in that church. You know, again, I think back to, you know, what Carmela Johns said in the second movie, that we, you know, that this is about worshiping at the altar of Smith and Wesson, that a religion of violence as such has taken the place of the tradition of Christ, of the tradition of Muhammad, of the tradition of Yahweh, of the tradition of all of the world religions, and this murder mass has taken its place. But it's, as you say, it has resonances with churches, even as targets of sacrificial violence against non-whites. Again, I mean, and as I said before, this is the trope of, or the image of the soul gets talked about a lot in this third film, and the state of different people's souls. I guess I want to make one contrast between sort of the climax of this third film and the climax of the second film, and different arguments that are made against the path of violence. I think what you just said is the most important thing to say, the way that in combating injustice, Black people are not permitted to even consider, you know, violence as an option. What I wanted to add to that is, in contrast to the second film, there is an argument against this violent course of action in the second film, in which the Frank Grillo character wants to take revenge. And Callie says to him, the young non-white girl says to him, it won't bring him peace. She makes the argument based on what it won't do for him. She says, if you commit this act of violence, it's not going to heal your soul. It's not going to bring you what you need. So the argument there is all about what he needs and what the effect will be for him. In the third film, when the senator says to Dante, don't go kill this guy. No one says to Dante Bishop, don't go kill this guy because it'll be bad for your soul. She's saying, don't go kill this guy because it'll be bad for me politically. So I think there's this trade-off in, again, whose soul matters. The way that this church is being set up, it's clearly a church in which only the white souls are meant to matter. I just think it's very, very telling that, you know, there could be potentially an argument where some you know, right-thing individual could at least make the pacifist argument, you know, Dante, this is not the right because this will do harm to your soul, you know, whether you want to make the argument or not. But no, it's not made in those terms at all, even though it's made in that way to the white character when he doesn't take his vengeance.
Wow. Keen observation. Again, Black folks are without souls. It even reminds me of the whole spat that's been going on the last few days with the Republican presidential nominee and the Muslim family, married couple that were at the Democratic National Convention, where I think the male came out castigating Don Trump, where he said that he has a Black soul. And I even pointed that out, just the anything nefarious, vile, being associated with black people don't have souls, which great line you already gave us in the broadcast. I'll see if I can nab some of the callers here. Folks have comments or questions, rather, if you have any questions of anything, if it was not clear, if you have a specific question about the films, I would appreciate it if folks could kind of be on topic and not just all over the place. I know sometimes people would like to talk about other films. We can just be on the Purge franchise. If you have a specific question for Dr. Kevorkian about his views on racism, that's fine. But we're not all over the place and talking about any and every television program or film that you may have seen during the broadcast. Just focused on what we're discussing this evening. Thomas in New York, if you had a question for Dr. Kevorkian, you should be with us.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Dr. Kevorkian.
Greetings.
Good evening, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Yes, very interesting commentary. Gus, you touched on a lot of my points. I do have two observations real quick. One is you talked about Black family and that girl that was mentioned in the last one, the little Catholic school girl who was coming back to kill Bubba Gump. She admitted to just killing her parents before she came back to kill him. And also innocent effeminate Charlie from the first one. I think that he seemed to be ignorant enough to let this black guy in. When he found out that his sister was to go into the hottest place that he hid the black guy, that fear of the black race went into his eyes. I mean, it looked like, oh, I got to get there to save her. I kind of got that from the first one. My question to you, sir, is do you think that there's any, it's obvious from going over the films that this is definitely the Purge is a cold word pretty much for war against black people. However, both events that happened, both Ferguson and Baltimore, the media reported it as the black people were going to purge, as like some type of email or something going around. They're associating this with black people. And I just want to know, do you find that interesting or not, or what's your thoughts on that?
So what you're saying is that these historical events, the recent events, were being portrayed as black people were going to go on a purge. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's how they portrayed it in the media. Both right before the riots in Ferguson, it was like a mass email that went out and warned, and the police were on heavy notice because there was talk about the youth going to purge. And that same thing was brought up during Baltimore, in particular when those young kids were throwing bottles at the police officers who stopped them from going to where they were trying to go. That's when they started bringing up that same notion of a purge coming out through the email form. And, they kind of ramped up the police presence after that. I just want to know if you had any thoughts to that.
Well, I mean, I mean, maybe this is not the most relevant response, but I was grateful that, Gusty Renegade at the top caught that point about the footage from the Rodney King period in the very, very, very beginning of the first film, that there is an anxiety about mass black violence that is sort of underneath all of this. So, I think you're right that even though what is portrayed in these films is largely whites purging, it's all framed against a backdrop of perhaps of anxiety about unrest in the black community. So if Mr. Renegade, if you'd like to add.
That happens with the recent incident in Baton Rouge as well. I just posted on my Facebook page the exact same thing, where there were these rumors it says specifically social media rumors hinted at a purge in Baton Rouge after the shooting of Alton Sterling. So I think Dr. Kevorkian hit it on the head. And it's been repeated many, many times since 2013 when this film came out. Anytime that there's been some sort of racial incident that, oh man, the Negroes are going wild and they're coordinating some sort of purge with Twitter or something on social media, it's happened repeatedly. And I think you hit it again, just going back to the Rodney King. That is the underlying theme in these films, that they're hitting on Negro unrest. Black people don't know their place and they need to be put down.
I just want to say, I think Thomas also pulled out some good details on that first film about we had neglected the specific incidents of where it seems like the sister is being potentially in a dangerous position. That is another way in which the black body is being coded as a threat, is whenever he's going to the hiding place for the sister, or when the sister is going to the same hiding place, that those bodies should not be together. We're supposed to see that that's going to be a dangerous thing.
Absolutely. Get my in before we get. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say also, Thomas making the point that the looters are potentially an emblem of that kind of unrest, that kind of black purging, mass violence. That they're not in the film; they're singled out as sacrificial targets. But I think it's it is probably useful to think of them as being indices of anxiety about unruly masses, that they stand for, you know, more, they stand for more bodies than they are on screen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The person that dialed in, appreciate that, Thomas in New York. I'm trying to see if we can nab as many folks as we can. The caller at 3637, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? 3637. Caller at 3637, excuse me, 3637, are you just listening or did you have a question?
Hi, yes, I had a question. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for coming to the show today. You used the term, it was called blood sport. What does blood sport mean?
Oh, I mean, that's, I guess I'm thinking back to something kind of ancient, like gladiator games. Maybe I'm thinking of the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie too, of the same name, but the idea that entertainment is to be had from watching people kill other people. In this film, you know, it's achieved by dehumanizing certain people. And as in the context that Gus has provided, it's a blood sport that has a racial edge to it. So I don't know if I'm using the term blood sport very precisely, but I think it's the kind of the way that these films want to appeal to the audience. That on the one hand, they want to say that this blood sport of the Purge is bad, but on the other hand, that's from start to finish, you know, in these kind of Purge feeds and in the action sequences, that's what it's delivering, is the spectacle of humans brutally killing other humans. I mean, it's sort of like the franchise is at odds with itself on the subject of blood sport or purging, because, you know, in the third film, supposedly all the people that you're rooting for want to get rid of the Purge. And then, you know, the senator wins the election, and now that there's not going to be any more purging. But on the other hand, if that really happens, then that's the end of the franchise. What one of the producers says, they said, you know, what do you want? He says, I want people to go in and get their adrenaline up and think, gee, I hope there's another Purge next year. And they also, one of the other producers says, I don't see how anyone could see these films and say, well, purging is a good thing. And then he kind of stops himself and he says, but, or maybe they would. You know, he's not, on the one hand, he wants to say purging is a bad thing. On the other hand, I think he understands that there is this somehow sick appeal of selling blood sport.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that. And just a couple more here. Now, do you think, because you were saying, you were talking about the minority, how people feel about, you know, the minority, we got to get rid of the minority. Do you think that white people realize that they are a world minority? I know there are a lot of white people in the United States. I mean, that's what they tell us from the numbers, is what they're telling us. But do you think that white people realize that they are a world minority? And my last question, with all of the killing, not just with Purge, but if you go back in the histories with the aggressiveness and the killing, kill, 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 just a lot of the times, and doing it for enjoyment, you know, walking someone to the gallows back in, you know, 16-something, and this was a good thing, you know. Even, you know, before the lynching of Black people, you know, it was done in Europe. So do you feel like this is white culture?
Yeah, I mean, your point is really well taken. I mean, as from the top, Gus says we should be precise in our language and think about the implications of our language. And yes, I mean, the term minority is really a misnomer when you think about the world population. And you ask, you know, do you think white people realize that they are in the world minority? I think if they fully realized it, they wouldn't use the term minority, right? So, I mean, you ask a good question. But on the other hand, I think that Donald Trump is now appealing to a dawning awareness that white people are in the minority and are starting to feel defensive about that. In terms of whether this kind of, you know, sadism, you might call it, or sort of, you know, blood sport or the kill, whether that's a particularly, you know, European pathology, I don't have enough knowledge of world cultures to say, but it certainly is prevalent in that tradition. And again, you know, I mean, all the examples I was thinking of is like, well, the Roman tradition in England, you know, certainly. But I'm not really a qualified commentator on, you know, world, you know, history in that way to know, you know, whether you could say that that's a unique pathology, but it's certainly the one that is on display in these films and is prevalent in America.
Appreciate that. 3637. The caller at 2534. Did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, guys. Good evening to all the callers.
If you could speak up, that would be helpful. You're a little low.
Is that better?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Good evening. Good evening to all. Good evening to the guests. I did have a question about the scene with the young where the young black females were in the store. And you know the their actions and that whole interaction. I guess I wanted to ask you as well, because should I view that also that it's perpetuating the myth of a worthless black male, and that you know, not even the black female will listen to him. He doesn't really have any control unless he has help, and. He is worthless unless he is protecting or saving or some kind of way promoting white life. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Gus, I believe he addressed that to you. Is that correct? Or?
I think he might have said both. I'll, you know.
Well, I agree.
Go ahead.
I agree that that supports Gus's earlier point that it's a way in which, even at the same time that it's portraying these young black women as being themselves targets for future purging, it's simultaneously showing Joe to be powerless. Yes.
Yeah, I would agree there as well. I think pretty much all of the black characters in these films come across as being pretty powerless. I think the only time that they're able to flex any real agency, as I think was stated, is in service to whites. But I don't think anybody in these films, does any black people displays any power on their own that's just about, you know, self-preservation or enforcing their will in what's going to happen on things. I don't think that's on display at all. I don't even think you see Irish Eyes securing his waffles from his worldview as presented at the beginning of the third film.
Yeah, and I'm even thinking of like you know, the somewhat like the menacing skate punks in the second film that wear that makeup, you know, the white makeup.
Mm.
And you think they're going to be kind of like the big scary characters, but then at the end of the film, you know, it's revealed that they were just looking for a payday, that they're just working for, and they're just working for the man, and that, you know, they're not some super, you know, scary predators. They're just getting paid and trying to collect and work for somebody else. And so they're kind of, even though they're set up as these big scary characters, they're even in their villainy, they're kind of diminished. I don't know if I should care about that or not, but I noticed that they were kind of, even that, they seemed to kind of be this powerful force and menace, but they it seems like the film went out of its way to diminish them even at the end.
Mm. Their agency in service to whites, once again. The person that dialed in 4231, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? You should be with us, 4231.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, peace to all the callers, to the host, and to the platform, and welcome to our guests. My main observation that I take from the discussion and the points that have been made is that basically the way that we talk about ISIS, excuse me, the way that we talk about ISIS and the way that we talk about the racist white supremacist system of sophisticated terrorism is pretty much the same to me. And when I look at these type of movies or I see this, and it just shows me the corruption and the ongoing crusade. And it's just basically a sophisticated form of terrorism where they want to dumb down the victim. But yet when it comes to a small, low budget, barely making it terrorist group called ISIS, and the religion of Islam is also always hinted to as being something that racist white supremacists don't like because of the firm values against racism, white supremacy, and basically letting a black person know that, hey, although a white person wants to say your soul is worthless in Christianity and maybe Judaism, and under Mohammedan, there's a whole total different outlook for you. And I see that racism, white supremacy, and their sophisticated form of terrorism works on many levels.
Sir, and this, I just we had a lot of folks. Yeah, if you can get to your question, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, do you think that black people should have a difference in how they view ISIS and how they view the racist white supremacists, the alleged Illuminati, all of that, the white Freemasons, Shriners, all of that?
Well, as I may have mentioned before, I think it's important that, you know, it's one of the things I like about the Carmelo John speech is that he mentions the betrayal of Muhammad as well as the betrayal of Christ. You know, I think that there's a way of as you think about it, you know, the scale of these things, it's true. But there is an analogy between, you know, the way that ISIS is talked about and the kinds of things that we've been talking about here. But I think it's also, you know, important to say just as, you know, ISIS, you know, can be seen very often as twisting or being a betrayal of the traditions of Islam, you know, using it in ways for, you know, hateful violence. It's the kinds of white supremacy that we see being shown in these films is very explicitly a perversion or a corruption of the Christian message. So I would say, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I don't know about, you know, to tell anyone how, you know, any one group of people should think about ISIS, but I think it's healthy to view both both white supremacists and violent Islamic extremism as really betrayals of certain religious traditions, all of which have a lot of potential. And we've talked about sort of the double-edged sort of religion in some of the other films when I've been on the show. I think when we talked about Nothing But a Man, Gusty Renegade pointed out that it's clear that in that film there's real corruption in the church, and sort of compromise of the black community through the church. But on the other hand, it's a source of wisdom and strength for the woman who is the main character, who you know, is taught there, as you can find in any of these traditions, that there is a message that should be emphasized, the universality of, you know, all human beings being valued, all their souls being valued, that all are children of God. And I think if you take the best of any of these traditions, I don't think you would find there's anything deterministic about any one of these religions that would exclude or naturally lead to racism or white supremacy. That's my feeling, though.
The caller at 1-842-1842, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Hello, Dr. Kevorkian. I know that you have your PhD, your doctorate in English, and I know that you don't know all cultures, but I do know that you're aware that this program is dedicated to informing victims of racism, white supremacy, on exactly what racism is, and trying to have constructive dialogue about what to do about it. I am particularly concerned with the nature of the Purge series. I also had an opportunity to check out the website, or the archived website, and I was really disturbed because I, for a really long time, didn't even know that was the trailer website. Like, I didn't know that's what I was looking at. I actually thought I was looking at an organization's website. I kept clicking links. They actually had information and, you know, all of that. And I realized, I said, oh, this is the movie trailer website. Anywho, with that being said, like I said, I know that, you know, you may not feel comfortable speaking on other cultures or whatever, but you have seen the films, have dissected it, but you overall, you understand that there's a message being sent. Would you say that that message is, it's okay for white people to just kill black people? And if that is the case, or something like that, I might not be wording it 100% correctly, but if that is the case, then as a white person who is having this conversation with us on this platform, what would you say to victims of racism, white supremacy, or non-white people about either to prepare or to be aware, or what do we do? I'll mute myself.
Yeah, it's a very fair question. It's a difficult question. I try to analyze these and critique them the best I can. And yes, I agree that particularly when you have that website out there on its own, you know, without any sort of context or understanding where it's coming from, it absolutely would come across as a promotion of the idea of being able to kill black people with impunity. And as Gus pointed out, this whole franchise is launched at the same moment when we see that playing out on the American stage in things like the George Zimmerman trial, where he was able to kill Trayvon Martin with impunity. So yeah, that's a messaging that is from that website, as you saw it. It's a messaging that can be found within this movie. Again, I think it's a movie that sends all kinds of mixed messages. I mean, as I said, there are people who watch this film and say, you know, this film is racist against white people. I said that, and Gus laughed inappropriately, but I'm saying people see the film and think that, and it makes them angry that way. I guess, you know, it's something that I think I've said before, but I would just ask you to weigh the analysis that you've heard that I've tried to give that has been enabled by Gus's conversation, enabled by these questions, and really make of it, you know, your own program for what you need to do. I'd be very hesitant to think that anyone should listen to my advice about what to do. And I don't mean to say that in a way not to be helpful. I mean, I'm someone who believes in education, And so I'd say, you know, get as much education as you can get access to, and Gus providing the show is one avenue of educating yourself. But, you know, beyond that, on steps to prepare, I'd be more comfortable leaving that kind of advice to Mr. Renegade.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question. Do you mind really quick, Gus?
Proceed.
Like me.
Proceed.
Okay. Just really quickly. Again, I know that, you know, you're not a psychologist or anything like that, but you are a white man. And so if you could, and I know that you've watched many films and dissected them, so you're able to see what white people are producing, what white people want other white people to know, and what white people are telling non-white people to know. So could you comment a little bit on white pathology? Gus had mentioned it at some point, and it seems like we kind of brushed over it really quickly. Like we started talking about something else, but we really didn't talk about what does the Purge series mean about white people. Not necessarily like, you know, images of what we see about black people, but what does it mean about white people that they enjoy this kind of violence, or that like this is part of their pathology or psychology? And I know that you've watched way more films and dissected way more films than I have, so I'm sure that you've seen this motif in a lot of films. Could you speak a little bit about that? Even if it's not within your purview of your degree, but just as a white man.
Thank you. For that, inviting me to speculate in that way, because I mean I think that these films are very powerful and disturbing, and are really a picture of white pathology. But the thing that I find, you know, potentially the most insidious is that on the one hand, these are films that portray white pathology in a way that is really unappealing, strangely, right? I mean, some of the most loathsome characters are, you know, those wealthy, privileged white characters, you know, carrying out their violence. And so I think that these are films that perversely allow an audience to both enjoy that white pathology subconsciously, at the same time where they think that they are rejecting it, where they think that it's not something that they are enjoying. You're allowed to think, oh, I don't like those people, at the same time that the movie is selling that enjoyment. I think it would be really hard to sell it straight for someone to both consciously and unconsciously be saying, yeah, that's really what I enjoyed, to admit that that's what the audience enjoys. So it gives the audience both an out to say white pathology is not me, at the same time that is still a part of the appeal of the spectacle. So that's the best attempt I can give it, kind of the double psychology of it. Trying to offer the enjoyment while offering a way of saying, but that's not really what you're enjoying. You really are against that. And I'm sorry if that's not helpful, but that's the closest I can come to thinking, you know, how could these films have such a broad appeal? Because really, and it's on some sense, on an individual sense, it's baffling. But then on the other sense, in a historical context, it's just all too real and plausible that these would be appealing.
I think we talked about one of the, I mentioned it already, Pulp Fiction, where there is violence against black people in one of the most celebrated films to come out in the last half century, I would say. I would for sure put Pulp Fiction on that list got nominated for Academy Awards. I think many people think that's Quentin Tarantino's finest work. And the climax is a black person getting his head, no one who will be missed, black male getting his head blown off and disposed of in it's a place where they take cars after they don't work anymore. It's like a dump site, basically. Tractor Joe's car lot or something, where they're just going to throw him in an old dump Carr and move forward with Marvin. It's standard operating procedure in the system of white supremacy and white entertainment. So I've said that the foundation of white supremacist entertainment is violence against black bodies. And that goes all the way back to P.T. Barnum and the circus. We talked about that. P.T. Barnum buying a black slave, Joyce Heth, putting her body on display when she died for dissection and charging people like a nickel to see her when she died, and speculating about how old she was and all of that. And Birth of a Nation, certainly we just had the 100-year. Matter of fact, I think the 100-year anniversary was just last year for Birth of a Nation, and certainly celebration of violence against black people. Long-running tradition, long-running aspect of white culture, I would submit. Great questions. The caller is 6492, 6492. Did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Hi, hello everyone.
Greetings. Hi, Joy.
Greetings. I haven't seen any of the Purge movies, but you know, just listening to this, I find it very disturbing. I interact with a lot of white people on social media, and I hear the same things over and over again, and I kind of just blew it off. But now listening to this, it's almost like, and I'm not sure, maybe this there's sort of like a parallel messaging going on. On one hand, these people, they're black, they're useless, they're worthless, get rid of them, good riddance. And black people, don't fight back, don't question, don't say anything, because it'll either get you killed too, or, you know, you can, you know, it's just not a good thing. Don't even think you're better than that. Is that what's going on? Is that the purpose of these movies? I can't even imagine why anyone would create such movies.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's a good summary of the messaging that we definitely see in these films. You know, I think sometimes people don't, sometimes they really know, but sometimes they don't completely know, or they don't admit to themselves what they're making or what they're doing. I heard, one of the interviews with one of the white actors, Zach Guilford, he's, the young man who's part of the young white couple, in the second film. And he said, you know, that, he said James DeMonaco was actually surprised at the response to the first film. He said he thought he was making a social commentary, and he thought he was making a satire. He thought he was making a commentary on sort of the grotesqueness of the privilege of the rich versus the poor. But then he was sort of surprised to see people really identifying with it. And one example he gave was like, this is a totally different way to respond to the movie, but people saying, yeah, I want to kill my boss. Saying, well, that wasn't what the franchise initially set out to be. But then seeing where its successes were, then deciding, well, if that's bankable, then, you know, in the words of the Ethan Hawke character, we're going to give them what they want. But yeah, I think it's right. It's almost impossible to think of someone setting out and saying, "Yeah, we're going to make this hateful thing," and I see see themselves as making it in that hateful way. But the fact is that, you know, we live in a culture that is racist. It's sort of deep in our history, and there are stories that get told that are just piggybacking on some of the old stories and borrow strength from them in ways that they probably don't even realize. You know, Gus, you just mentioned Birth of a Nation. I mean, that has been so influential on the rest of cinema and even on people who don't even realize that they're being influenced by the way that big screen epic was told. And also, again, just as Gus led off the show, by talking about the fact, people say it's just movies, these have real effects, as in the Indiana man who's doing the killing. Obviously, Birth of a Nation was one that was not just about negative portrayals, but it sparked off actual violence against black bodies. It was done at a time when maybe that was actually something that it could be thought of as a conscious goal. But I think you're right that the kind of thinking that goes on with these movies has to be a kind of double messaging or double thinking that the movies end up sending out far more hateful messages than anyone could consciously or that I would like to think or consciously set up, well, yeah, we want to do that kind of story.
Before I get Roz, I just wanted to insert that website, in my opinion, I'm not sure if I believe Mr. DeMonaco. As I said, this is not the first time that he's done a movie that basically the plot is a group of whites conspiring to kill one black person. That website and the authenticity of the website and the is it human nature to purge? That being one of the poll questions. I'm not sure if I believe him when he says that the original agenda was to make a satire about privilege, class privilege, certainly not talking about anything to do with white supremacy, racism, but a satire and then seeing how people responded, we kind of went the other way. I'm not sure if I believe that, but that I could be misreading things. Roz, did you have a comment, question for Dr. Kevorkian? Roz, you should be with us.
Oh, yes. Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to you, Dr. Kevorkian. Yeah, I did have a couple of questions, but I wanted to ask you about what you just said. Did you say that the maker of the franchise said that all humans purge?
Are you asking me or Dr. Kevorkian?
I'm asking you because I think you were talking about him just now. Am I correct?
Oh, I said on this website that they have, it was set up. It's not online now, but you can see the archive of it. They had a website set up for the new founding fathers. And one of the questions, it was a poll question. It was, is it human nature to purge? And this is one of the poll questions. And you could respond. You could, you know, submit your answer and see the poll results. But I said that just having a website like that that looks so authentic and it looks like some sort of legitimate real world political organization, that having a website like that that is all about endorsing that, yes, the purge is great. I don't believe the white filmmaker, Mr. James DeMonaco. I don't believe his report that they started out to make some sort of commentary about privilege and then saw the audience response and kind of went a different route with, I guess, their marketing and their idea about this franchise. That was what I said.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, like, just in the context of the film and white supremacy, when the question was posed, all humans purging, I would basically say all white people, because as far as the context of the movie, the only true humans are white people in the film. So I think that term human is really referring to white people specifically and not non-white people. But to get to my question, to piggyback off of Dr. Kevorkian's prior discussion regarding the gladiator or Roman Colosseum kind of scenario with the purge, I wanted to ask, simply because of the fact that the purge is really like really art imitating life, because what's happening to black people is essentially what's happening on the purge, and essentially it has become a planetary phenomena. Neely Fuller always discusses white supremacy as a planetary plantation. Would you say that white people, because they have conquered the known world, that they have now created a planetary coliseum? And the purge is kind of reflective of that, especially with the fact that American culture is so widely absorbed by all kinds of people around the world. That's my first question.
I think that I just want to say that's a great, great phrase to think about the concept of planetary plantation becoming planetary coliseum. I think that's a powerful formulation and terrifying as well. But yeah, it is art imitating life. And also want to, you know, and say that yes, I do agree with that analysis that it's about the films are definitely about whites as the humans. I mean, just to kind of go along with what Gus was saying about what the filmmakers really think they're up to, these are a couple of quotations from producers. This is from the Behind the Anarchy making of video. We think the audience has wanted to see more than we gave them in the first film. What would be more fun than hunting humans in a sculpture garden? This is another producer says, in the oddest, most depraved way, it's a fantasy of what you could do if you could kill whoever you wanted to on that one night. So here talking about it, about in terms of fulfilling a fantasy, about it being fun, seeing people being killed. But again, hunting humans, when you say hunting humans, already the term hunting suggests the pursuit of an animal, and presenting that as fun, as sport, is actually something that, in that Making of Anarchy, that's what the producers say, that's what the audience wanted to see more of, and that's what this franchise is going to deliver. But thank you for that well-made phrase, the planetary coliseum, indeed.
And I have one more question. That was, who would you say is more confused, in your opinion, as a white person about racism, black people or white people? And to give context, just looking at the Purge film franchises and all the numerous films that have come out that denigrate black people, I would just say there's a high level of refinement of the system in the fact that there are so many black people participating in self-denigrating film, but in especially films like this that depict such incredible violent and heinous deaths of black people in all these various forms. So I just wanted to know, who would you say, in your opinion, is more confused about racism, white supremacy, black people or white people? Thank you. And thank you for being on the program this evening, sir.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you to all the callers. Thank you to Gus. And I'll go back in time and to answer a little bit about, you know, the way confusion and deception works in a racist system. This is from the Confessions of Nat Turner, when he's talking about his childhood that eventually led to him leading a slave revolt. Despite everything being stacked against him, learned to read. And he says, the black people around me were more surprised than the white people that I had learned to read. And I just thought that is a really powerful insight of the kind of confusion that can take place under oppression and lack of access to learning. That statement reveals a kind of bad faith on the part of the white people. In other words, when he says the black people were more surprised that I could learn to read than the white people were, right? That means that the white people had been telling the lie that black people were not capable of learning. But it means that the white people, because they were originators of that lie in that culture, they knew it was a lie. But the black people, that is all that they had been told. So when Nat Turner is able to read, it surprises the people around him more than it surprises the white people. They knew that they were lying. So I don't know if that applies to all areas of confusion. I think there are probably a lot of things about white supremacy that white people are confused about and that I'm confused about. I can't claim the aspects of it that baffle me, but I think I really do think of that Nat Turner moment as exemplifying how the people in power who control the lies are less confused about it than the people who have been forced to, who have never known anything other than the lie. And I think that might go with what you're saying about what happens to black people as victims of racism, even being led to participate in it.
Fascinating. Our caller in Michigan normally asks that type of question about confusion. Very, very rarely does anyone, white or non-white, submit that non-white people are more confused about racism. That is, I mean, like, I could count on one hand the number of times that anyone has said that, oh yeah, I think black people, non-white people are a tad more confused about this racism thing. Very rare. And I agree. I think it's non-white people in a system of white supremacy. You cannot be white and be ignorant about there. As The Purge illustrates, there are expectations of you as a white person, and white people will let you know when you have made an error, like providing sanctuary for a Negro. Two callers left and we'll be all done. Mr. Nero already mentioned white people kill for fun. Mr. Nero, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? Mr. Nero, you with us, sir? Did you have a question?
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers. May I be heard?
Yes, we can hear you. Your line was breaking up. Yes, sir. Your line was breaking up a little bit. Yeah. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. Dr. Kevorkian, great to have you on the broadcast.
Yeah, it's great to have already had your words with us even before you called in.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Let me ask you something before I ask my question in regards to film. I'm just curious, kind of personal. Have you ever dated a black female before?
I have not.
You have not, okay. Let me ask you, because you mentioned nothing but a man. Can you maybe share with me the contrast between the relationship between black males and black females from that film as it equates to the franchise of The Purge?
Yeah, I mean, what I remember, it's been a while, but I mean, it is a wonderful, woman at the center of that film who, you know, is in a, what I see is a loving relationship with a black man and is trying to help him out of his confusion, to help him see himself, as a man. And I mean, you don't see those kinds of that kind of a supportive relationship in anywhere in the Purge film. Did you have? I'd be happy to hear you expound on that because I suspect you have.
I'm wondering if you feel that's accurate in real life. I mean, do you see black males and black females? Do you see them connected? Or do you see them as two separate groups based on the series, The Purge franchise, I should say?
Oh, yeah. So, right. There are, there are just minimal points of connection. We have, even the father being separated from the daughters. Even that is not portrayed on screen, the non-white man is taken off and sacrificed. So yeah, in the realm of representation, they're kept separate. I don't think that's reality. I mean, that's not reality as I know it.
Okay, so you see black males and black females connected, more connected than the film portrayed.
I do. I mean, I'm fortunate to know people who are in good relationships, but that's what I know and that's what I see. I think that there's probably real challenges that are faced in this world, but the way it's set up. But I think that separation is not inevitable.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I will yield the rest of my time because I know there's another call, and I know you've been on for over 3 hours. I just wanted to get your take on it. So, but thanks for coming on the broadcast. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Nero.
Hang on. Final caller. Caller at 4693. 4693, do you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yes, I do have a question. Hello there, Gus.
Greetings.
Basically, what I wanted to touch on was that when you look at movies like The Purge and its comparison with, I'm trying to compare it with what happened to the Jewish people in Nazi Germany. And when you look at movies like this, because most white people do not stay around black people, they get most of their information from what they see on TV. So when you look at what happened in Germany before Hitler started to exterminate the Jewish people, they set them up into classification: German Aryans against the minority group, much like in the United States. The white Protestant American against the minority groups, most specifically black people. The second thing they did was blame them for polarization, blame the Jewish people for bringing down the German economy. The third thing they did, which is what whites are doing if you look at any of Dr. Claude Anderson's work, was that they excluded the Jewish people from German society. And that is just, and you can see the same exercises that has been happening against African Americans here, in the Dred Scott decision and the benign neglect policies. And when you look at the third thing, they use the media, and what that is called is propaganda, much like you see on The Purge when you have, you know, the drugstore incident. I mean, the store incident about the kids trying to break into the store and how they got ran over, you know, shot in the head. And they basically call Jewish people inferior, much like whites call black people inferior, as a matter of fact, and classify them as superhuman. And then they created the IQ test to justify, you know, the intellectual inferiority of, to falsely justify the intellectual inferiority of the Jewish people, much like you see with blacks going on today in public schooling. And, you know, they created the special education program in 1969. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing made the most important statement, was that the justification of Hitler exterminating the Jewish people was based on the fact that they were non-white. And the justification of black people, that white people try to make against black people in America, is the fact that we are black and we are non-white. Now, of course, all minorities are being oppressed, but the type of oppression that black people
sir, can you get to your question?
Do you believe that America is setting up African Americans for the single most greatest Holocaust in human history as we speak, based on the principles I've just mentioned? Because there's some sort of similarity that is happening to black people in America, much like what happened to the people in Nazi Germany.
I'll say just very clearly that I hope not, but I also see the analogies that you're making, and they're ones that there's validity in this scapegoating, the way that the blame is asserted. I don't know. There's another book that just came to mind. It's called Rituals of Blood by Orlando Patterson. He's a professor at Harvard, and he, in one of his chapters, it's called Rituals of Blood, Consequences of Slavery in Two American Centuries. And he also does draw on some analogies to Nazi Germany in talking about the history there. But, I think that there is there's violence that's happening right now. I don't think that there's anything on that sort of scale that would happen in that way. I don't foresee that. But I think there is real violence that is already happening now. And the only thing I can say about that is that at the very least, such acts of violence against blacks in America are at last drawing more negative attention than they once did.
And I have one more question. Now, with the scene of the African American youth in the movie being ran over and killed, it kind of drew my attention to Robert Kirkman's comic book version of the game, The Walking Dead. And that was the scene in the beginning of the game where there's this is the beginning of the game. There was a scene, this African-American girl walked inside the restroom and tried to rob the character by the name of Clementine. Omid, which is the character of the white pregnant lady, walked inside and she turned around and the gun went off. She killed him. Now,
this African-American girl was talking with all kinds of slangs and stuff. And there was this later scene about this pregnant black mother. She had a loud mouth. Her husband was afraid of her, who just so happened to be black. And come to find out, the baby who she was pregnant, who when she was pregnant, the baby didn't even belong to him. It belonged to a white man the whole time. So she was pregnant by a white man inside the movie. I mean, inside the game. So do you believe that, because a lot of people don't, for the most part, don't ever touch on a racism in gaming. Like, there's a huge form of racism that's happening in your video game right now. And I'm a huge video game fan. And do you think that in video gaming, they are trying to condition the minds of younger white youth to have some sort of psychological mindset towards people of darker hue, people who are black, people who are considered African?
Well, I would say if you're seeing those patterns then that in those video games, then that's an indication that the people who are making those games already have those mentalities inside them. And whether they're trying to consciously pass that on or whether it's just an expression of their own miseducation, I don't know. But I think that's why it's healthy once we notice these patterns to call them out, to make it clear that these sorts of patterns are not acceptable and are destructive, should not be passed on, should not be part of a miseducation system.
Okay, that's all I had. You can mute the line, guys.
Appreciate Dr. Kevorkian, you sharing your time with us this evening. Before we let you go, I had said I wanted to hear how the robot, your analysis from the first Purge film, and how the robot may be related to what you touched on in Color Monitors, or just what you thought about Charlie's use of the robot in the Purge number one.
Oh, well, thank you for asking, and thank you for your patience. I sometimes ramble on and on while I'm just trying to figure out what I'm going to say. And I'm sorry for the length of all of my answers. But one of the things I noticed about Charlie is that he even seems to be wearing glasses that remind me of the first Terminator. I don't know if that struck you or not, that, you know, it's one of his ways of sort of compensating for his feebleness is that he sort of tries to take on this kind of Terminator power by controlling this little doll by remote control. And he seems to wear those shades like Schwarzenegger had. But the thing that I was thinking about was this reminded me of a conversation that we had when we talked about The Blind Side. And I was thinking really of the trajectory that happens between Terminator 1 and Terminator 2. In Terminator 1, the Terminator, played by Schwarzenegger, is this machine that is increasingly sort of just stripped down. The more it gets damaged, the blacker it becomes, right? Just like the doll that Charlie has. It's just kind of this, it was a doll, but now it's all burnt out and it's become blackened. And it's about this machine that relentlessly is going after Sarah Connor. It's all about a machine that is just seen as programmed to go after the white woman. And I think there's a way in which that relentless pursuit by this masculine machine is something that reflects on the history of fears of the black man perceived as the predator of the white woman. And I think that's one of the residues of that pursuit. Time up?
Oh, no, that means something else entirely.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. In Terminator 2, what happens is that the Terminator says, come with me if you want to live. This is now somehow the threat of the Terminator has been neutralized, and the Terminator in Terminator 2 almost becomes the toy of that young boy, the Edward Furlong character. He's always telling the Terminator, do this, do that, and he has kind of almost a remote control power over this Terminator 2. And so I started thinking of that relationship between the young boy in Terminator 2 and the Terminator when I saw Charlie controlling that robot and using that robot to send messages and to essentially lead around the black bloody stranger who comes into the house. He doesn't talk to him. He's not in the same physical space for him, but there's a way in which he sort of leads him to that hiding space. He leads him to go hide in the closet by using the robot. And it's almost as if, just like in Terminator 2, where it goes from the threat of the black body to the controlled robot, that we have this potential threat of the intruder in the house, in the white family's house, to the little boy sort of directing this figure by means of his remote control robot. I know I mentioned that came up in our discussion of The Blind Side, but I don't know if you may recall the young black man who comes to live with a white family is a talented football player, and they make a video of him, and they call it the Terminator. But many of the interactions between the young boy and this large young man who's come to live at their house are very reminiscent of that sort of thing. The little boy is always telling him what to do, and he exists only to protect that young boy. It's, again, this idea that he exists for the protection of the white family, just as the Terminator 2 ultimately exists for the protection of Sarah Connor and her son, just as Bloody Stranger, even in the first film, eventually offers himself up in sacrifice to protect the family. So that's more than everything I had to say. Thank you for letting me say it.
Wow. I think the robot and Bloody Stranger, the black male, they actually team up to save the white family at the end when they are about to be butchered by their white neighbors. The robot is the distraction that gets them to look the wrong way, and then the black male comes in to save the white people. That trope once again, but I think they are connected. That's how the first film ends, pretty much. I hadn't even thought about that, but I did remember the robot and connecting with your work. I thought you might have a word or two. I hadn't even thought about that. The doll is blackened. Folks see the first film like it's been burned or what have you. It's a little white baby that he is using like a drone in the house, basically. That is, I'll have to even give that some more thought. I'm glad I remembered to ask that. You can hear more if you go back in the archives where we discussed Dr. Kevorkian and his views on the Terminator and why in the second film Sarah Connor's child is wearing a Public Enemy Fear of a Black Planet t-shirt in that film and what that means about racism, white supremacy. All of that is in his book, Color Monitors. Great information. Get the book and or you can go in the archives and hear our discussion on it way, way back in 2009, May of 2009. It has been quite an exchange of views. Grand to have you back on the program to hear your thoughts on the series of films. Really appreciate you sharing a bit of your Wednesday evening with us, and I'm sure there will be some more flicks that come out that listeners will want to hear a word or two on, so we'll look forward to having you back on the program sometime soon, Dr. Kevorkian.
Well, it's always an honor, and thank you as always, Mr. Gusty Renegade, for being such a gracious host.
For sure, for sure. University of Texas, Austin, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, enjoy the rest of your evening. We will be in touch, sir.
All right. Thank you.
For
Take
sure.
Thank you.
Evening. Context of white supremacy. I don't even recall what number in terms of how many times he's visited. I think he's close to the double-digit range, even though it has been, I think, like 5 years since we had him on the program. You can go back. We talked about Nothing But a Man with the great Abby Lincoln, the black female character in that. We talked the Terminator films, The Blind Side, Solo, which is a Mario Van Peebles film, also about a robot. I mean, tons of films. The Bank Job, lots and lots of films. I think we even did Avatar and some of the others. I think we did one of the Rocky films, Hancock with Will Smith and Charlie's Throne, a slew of films over the years. You can go back in the archives and get some of the many items that we've discussed down through the years. One quick thing I did want to get in, I thought it was hugely important. The end of the third Purge film, where Joe, the black male, who again is Bubba in Forrest Gump, where he owns a store. And as Dr. Kevorkian pointed out, he's got like a photograph of, I think, Dr. King, Minister Malcolm X. I think one of the people in the photograph is Marcus Garvey. Again, I'd have to look again. It's kind of a, it's a quick shot and it's kind of from a distance. So I'm giving a guess, but I think one of them could be Marcus Garvey. Anyway, so his store gets burned down, looted, and Joe sacrifices himself to save a white woman, a senator. The film ends, you see Marcos, and Joe had already said he was going to make Marcos a partner. Marcos is this Latino male. Marcos is presumably now the shop owner. You see him repairing the shop. He's painting it and putting everything back in place and getting it all fixed up so they can operate it. And they've got a picture in memorial to Joe. I thought that was massive commentary in terms of plans. This is supposed to be dystopian future. There's a considerable time jump between the third film and the second film. I think the first and second films, they're supposed to be like 2022 and 2023. The third film is supposed to be 2040. 2040 or 2041, but it's like almost 20 years have passed by the time that you get to the third film. So this is way, way down the road that you're looking, relatively speaking. But I think that is a massive commentary where a black business owner is killed and a quote unquote Latino male takes over his store. And now he's in charge operating. Massive commentary. And that's how it ends, where we started with black people sitting around in this store talking about their whole goal in life is waffles and sex. It ends with the black store owner being dead. A Latino has taken over the store. I did not anticipate it taking this long to get through all the films. I did know that, you know, the three films, that's a bit I mean, we've done programs before with Dr. Kevorkian where we discussed, I think, four or five films on the program, and we got it done in 3 hours. Now, some of that is we do have more callers than we had before. Some of that also, I think, is these films do have a lot of layers. These are films that I've been taught, anybody who's been listening to The Cows over the past few years, I have referenced The Purge regularly, and saying that I think this is a part of the zeitgeist. That was one of the things I wanted to make sure I got in terms of representing this particular time in this part of the world, in terms of if you want to get a flavor for how you end up with someone like Donald Trump, being this close to the White House, and what you're seeing, this notion of let's brand Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization, and the violence that you're seeing, whether it's police terrorism or any of the other forms that it's taken, destruction of black schools, black neighborhoods, black business, black wealth, put that in quotes, all of the forms that racism, white supremacy is taking in this particular part of the world. I think this film franchise, great snapshot, and is encouraging an escalation of violence against black people. I would even say a celebration of white pathology, white terrorism in these films. It's blatantly, you see the white goons in the third film, they've got white power and everything on their uniforms. I'm not sure if I'm interested in going way, way long to make this a 4-hour program, but if folks have a quick sentence they would like to get in before we conclude, I think I can tolerate that. The folks that chimed in to ask questions, if you all have a quick sentence you need to get in before we wrap up, I can deal with that. If not, we can go ahead and wrap now because we've done the 3 hours plus our OT. Anybody need a quick sentence they want to get in on something they heard during the program? Everybody good. That's fine, too. Certainly did our work for today. We'll be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. But anybody, any quick sentences, sentence they need to get in before we wrap up, or is everybody satisfied?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I think you said that a line in the movie, the guy said something about waffles and sex, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So when I hear that, I hear that waffles and sex and that the chicken is silent. So that still sounds like a chicken joke towards black people, but the chicken was silent. That's what I wanted to say about that comment.
Right on. Right on.
Yes. Oh, I wanted to. I wanted to chime in too. In reference to when Dr. Kevorkian answered my question, I think what he said about deception was brilliant, and how brilliant, how it manifests itself in Black people in that way. And I like that, the fact that he used Nat Turner as an example, and the fact that the people around him were convinced that, you know, they themselves and Black people in general couldn't read. And the white people knew the Black people better than they knew themselves, to the point where they weren't surprised about it. I think that entire discussion, the point that he made was just very poignant. And that's why I kind of gave the caveat as far as describing the fact that we actually participate in these films. So what does this say about the confusion? Who is actually really confused when you look at the overwhelming number of denigrating movies that are made and are actually, you know, multi-million, sometimes billion-dollar movies about, you know, either destruction of Black life or the denigration of Black people in some form or fashion. And, you know, I just thought it was a great, great little thing that he discussed, and that confusion, because we talk about that quite often on the program. And I think just because he's been on the show so many times before, he really is perceptive, and he listens to what you talk about as far as the importance of words. So I think he's actually a really good guest as far as just him being open with his ideas and his understanding of things to the best of his ability. Again, he's still a white person. This is a system of white supremacy, but I find the discussion to be very constructive. Thank you.
Oh, he's an admitted white supremacist. That might be a reason to go back and listen to the very first time he was on the program, where he admitted that. That even is the reason that he came back so many more times, was that I amended the description to include that when he was here the first time, to include that he was an admitted white supremacist, and the power of white people's technology. That ended up being like on the first page of Google. When you searched his name, that would pop up an admitted white supremacist. So he asked if I could take it down. And I said, well, that feels like I'm supporting racism. There would have to be a cost associated with that. Like, you have to agree to be a guest on that program. Like, I don't know, it was like 10 times or something to do, which he said, fine. I think I even asked for something else too, which he said he was agreeable to do. So then he subsequently came back a whole bunch of more times, but admitted, not just a white man, admitted white supremacist. And his response to when he admitted is pretty revealing as well. Yeah, put that in.
And I
was just going to say, and he has that PhD in English too. I think I always try to point that out when we have white people who have some expertise with words, that they should be closely studied, because they tend to have just words are the main tool. So whites that have a special level of skill with the use of words, you should pay a special attention to.
I agree. And I would just say, because I'm going to go back now and definitely listen to the first episode again, because it's been a while. But I would say he's highly refined, probably one of the most highly refined people you've had on the show. I'll put it to you like that. Wow. Interesting. But I would just say his conversation is revealing. But I would say being with the information that you just provided, it kind of reminds me in a way of Sam Bachman. Like, even though he's being pretty open, I would say, there's a loftiness, a white supremacist loftiness with which the information is coming from. So you can be comfortable, like you said, with the wordplay as an English professor, because you're a white man when it's all said and done, you know, when it's all said and done, regardless. So very interesting. Thank you for that that insight. I appreciate it.
For sure. sorry. Thomas, did you have a quick sentence you needed to get in before we conclude?
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to add, in the third one, there was also use of a drone, which wasn't used in the first two either. So it's been a pattern of the robotic, you know, the remote control robotic use, where the drone was following them and able to give the purges a pinpointed, you know, location on people they were trying to purge. I'll
meet
my
line.
Thank you.
Great show. Yep. I was going to bring that up in connection with the Dallas thing, but can't get to everything. The white man shoots down a drone in the third one as well. They're being hunted, and they're even able to discern that this is not a government-owned operated drone. This is just some, you know, garage project that someone has made to participate in all these shenanigans. They even give the impression that this drone might even be able to inflict some violence on people, but they shoot it down. The white man shoots it down. The caller 1491, do you have a quick sentence you need to get in? You just listening, or did you have a sentence you need to get in?
Okay. I'm sorry, Gus, hello?
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, can I hear you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm sorry, I was listening live, and I'm actually in my vehicle, but I was listening live, and I kind of came in on the part where he was, I believe, discussing Norm Stepper's view on how blacks should combat, I guess, violence, well, police violence. And I was kind of unclear about what he had said. Could someone break that down for me real quick? I'd greatly appreciate it.
It'll be in the archives. It was basically just
the
white people in the Purge films, or at least in the third Purge installment. There's a lot of discourse about telling these black people that they cannot commit acts of violence. And I brought up Norm Stamper and him saying the same thing, that black people could not respond with violence in dealing with police terrorism. And we were talking about that aspect of whites trying to control how black people respond to oppression, white supremacy, and limiting their responses, certainly not allowing for violence in response to this problem. But it's in the archives. You can hear it.
Okay. Thank you. Will do.
For sure. For sure. Everybody satisfied? Any final thoughts? Anybody that we haven't heard from who had a final sentence they needed to get in before we conclude?
May I be heard?
Oh. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Actually, I learned something today. I actually, you know, kind of blown off fiction just as fiction, but now I see it is actually revealing in at least what their fantasies are. And then as you were speaking with Dr. Kevorkian, I remember there was a statement by Malcolm X that said that the movies and the books, and he studied them because it did, they would give you clues as to what they're up to. And I thank you for the show.
Appreciate that, Joy. Thought I heard one of the person who had a comment they wanted to get in. Also forgot to mention Dr. Kevorkian, the cowbell rung. I think Dr. Kevorkian is one of a hand, and I mean, we have done like in the neighborhood of 1,500 programs at this point. I think Dr. Kevorkian is one of the few guests that we've had in 7+ years who asked, what is that there cowbell? What does that mean? You can go back and hear that in the archives as well. But he is one of the few, in addition to Dr. Rasayan, maybe one or two others, who did ask what the meaning of the cowbell is. Anyway, was there another person who had a quick sentence they need to get in, or folks satisfied?
Yeah, that was me. I was just going to say, you know, for the last couple of weeks, there's been an active purge in Turkey. And I find it real funny that every time it's a purge in real life, it's non-white people, but the movies make it very clear that, you know, the purges are supposed to be the white people. But just very interesting how, you know, now the Turkish people are purging, and every time it's a riot, they're the purges, but it's never correlated to the white people.
For sure. You can just pay attention. Anytime there's some sort of racial incident, it's very frequent. If it's a police shooting or something where black people are justifiably upset about being terrorized, and it's, oh, they're getting on Twitter and they're going to do some purge attack. Like I said, it just happened with the shooting of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I posted that link on Facebook. Folks satisfied? Anybody that we haven't heard from who had a final sentence they need to get in before we conclude?
Yeah, I have one last statement. Even though Dr. Kevorkian didn't agree with my analysis, I know I'm not the smartest person in the world, but when you look at what happened in Nazi Germany, it looked very similar to what they're trying to do to us over here. I mean, I really think that we are being set up for an extermination campaign because we are a nation, we are under desired nation in the United States. And the signs of them justifying our inferiority
them miseducating us and then coming up with the IQ test, which came from Nazi Germany to, you know, make it seem like we have a lower IQ. I really think that we are being set up for an extermination campaign. And with these movies, they are conditioning other people to not see us as human. And John D. Rockefeller said the point of propaganda is to convince others that a particular group of people is not human. So when you look at the very aspect of Nazi Germany, it seems very similar to the United States. You know, the Nazi foot soldiers of Nazi Germany can be compared to what Henry Fuller called the race soldiers, which is the crooked police officers that are killing us unjustifiably. So that's all I wanted to say.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. We will wrap things up. We should be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism. Normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be looking for. We'll be looking forward to hearing from folks who have commentary on their workplace situation. If you have thoughts, feel free to dial in. If you would like to email, that would work as well. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Huge thanks to all the folks for listening. Hope you got some constructive information. If you do not want to check out these films, it's no problem. I'm sure they will have all kinds of anti-Black material to peruse coming down the pike. Just stay tuned. More of it to come. They'll probably have another Purge installment before you know it. So if you haven't seen them, don't worry about it. More to come. Thanks again for all the participants. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy this Wednesday evening. Again, for what you heard this evening, for sure, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's make sure that we are able to make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible under conditions of white terrorism. Buckle up every time you're in a vehicle. We want to do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.